Here.
Beanstalk? Christensen?
Yes, thank you.
Dinar?
Present.
Goodman? Carmo?
Here.
Morrow? Pena? Seaman?
Here.
Absent is El Gindi.
Did we have a quorum there?
We only have five.
Yeah, I counted five. Who else did we expect to attend right now?
Vicky Pena is planning on attending. Yasmin, do you have the list? Vicky, I know, is in, I don't know what you call it, clinic. Parma, did I get that right? She's like in clinic. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
So she's going to jump on as soon as she, and she said she'd be available. I thought Dr. Morrow was going to be available. For yes. Those that don't know, Morgan Berg resigned yesterday. Dr. Morrow just joined, so now you have six. So
great. Dr. Morrow, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Good. Sherry, do you want to redo the roll call?
Yes. Hero?
Yes.
Beanstalk? Christensen?
Yes.
Dinar?
Present.
Goodman? Carmo?
Here.
Morrow?
Here.
Pena? And Seaman?
Here.
And El Gindi is absent.
Okay, great. Thank you, Sherry. And Ryan, I'm sorry for cutting you off, but go ahead.
No, you're good. So I don't even know what I was saying, but let me just cover a couple of logistical things. Before I go through that, I will state that Morgan Berg, you can address this again on Friday, Dr. Hero. Morgan Berg is the business entity member. She resigned yesterday, so she will no longer be actively participating in any board meeting. So I don't know who communicated with her on the board, but feel free to continue to communicate her, but not about board activity. And then I reached out to the governor's office, and hopefully we've been trying for about a year and 4 months to get either her reappointed or somebody else in her seat. She now, it will have to be somebody in her seat. She's completely resigned. So you will have, on an 11-member board, you now have 10 members. The quorum is still six. If I can, Dr. Hero, can I go ahead and give some logistics on meeting will go? So you may have noticed attending today is Kristen, I can't pronounce your last name. Is it Wunsch? Is that how you say that? Okay. Either way, she is your court recorder. We thought it would be best so that we capture all of this and based on the longevity of it, how long it's been going on, to have a court reporter present to capture everybody's comments. That being said, this meeting is a board meeting. The board are the members that are actually going to be discussing all public comments that have been received during the oral proceeding timeframe, which has now expired. Today will not be an open forum to allow people to just freely communicate to the board. The only reason why you would be speaking other than the board members is if there's a direct question to you. So like, for instance, Dr. Caputo, I see he's in attendance and he had multiple comments that he provided during the the oral proceeding open comment period. If there's a clarification or a need that the board has with Dr. Caputo, then they would address him specifically. Likewise, Dr. Lau is also in attendance today, and I don't think he provided any public comment, but he is a pediatric dentist. So if there's a question regarding pediatrics, especially in lieu of the fact that Dr. Beanstock is not planning on attending, there may be a question in his way as well. So that's how this meeting will go. If you can wait till you're called upon because of the court reporter, we try to get one person speaking at a time. Because it's only for open or the comments that were received, the board will basically be accepting, rejecting, or modifying those comments into the notice of public rulemaking that was filed with the Arizona Secretary of State. I do not think that this will be our last time that this board will meet to discuss these topics or this topic. We likely will have to renotice, which is fine. And Jessica can explain that later if needed. Jessica Thomas, as you know, has been instrumental in the process and is the board's rules administrator. And she will be basically helping facilitate the meeting, if not running the whole thing, alongside Dr. Hero. I think I covered everything. I don't know, Dr. Hero, if you have any questions that I can maybe answer.
No, I think the only thing I would expand on with regards to who the board may be calling on to speak today, and your example of Dr. Lout was on point. What I would just say is not only is he a pediatric dentist, but he's a former member of the Anesthesia and Sedation Committee that spent a good 4 years working on this. There's other former committee members logged in as well from what I can see, and I anticipate potentially calling on some of them if we need clarification. What I do want to avoid is all former committee members, all board members getting into some big, robust back and forth conversation. I think we want to, for the sake of efficiency, try to limit conversation to the board, unless, like you said, Ryan, we have a specific question where we would address a non-board member. So with that said, let's move to agenda item number 2, declaration of conflicts of interest. Any board members need to declare anything? If not, then let's move to agenda item 3, notice of proposed rulemaking. Jessica, can you hear me?
Yes, can everyone hear me?
Yes, thank you for being here again.
Yeah, of course.
Jessica, my thought, and honestly, I'm going to defer to you on how you want to run this, but is to just go section by section rather than individuals that submitted written potential edits to the board rather than going through like all of Dr. Arnall or Dr. Caputo's comments. My thought was to just take it section by section and kind of backfill those comments in, unless you have another way you want to go about doing this.
No, that's fine. What I did is I took some of the comments, and I think Ryan took some of the comments and put them into the draft as well. And so I've got what I think are 2 drafts. One is in, I believe, a PDF version that Ryan put Dr. Caputo's comments in, as well as I think someone else's comments as well. Dr. Snell, I want to say. And then I've got my version, which is our working version that I can share. And I've got some of the other comments that were submitted as well. So I can go section by section, and I will kind of look at both of those documents on my end, and we can make changes as necessary to the working version, if that's okay with everyone.
Yeah, I think that sounds great. Before we start, is Dr. Skip Harris logged in right now?
Yes, sir.
Skip, why don't you, your comments were more general. I didn't see specific line item ones. And I think, you bring up, you know, some good concern. Why don't you go through that first before we get into the kind of the meat of this?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. Distinguished committee, I have spent a good portion of my career kind of focusing on adverse events and training, and that's kind of a professional hobby of mine. And having had an opportunity to read and investigate pretty much every adverse event that's occurred in the state of Arizona over the last 20 years, I want to say that I don't think lack of training is the problem with our adverse events and issues we've had with anesthesia. It's usually unavoidable or a result of hubris. So I think I have a little bit of an exception adding the simulation man training to the requirements for 1301 or for any of the permits, primarily because I think we need more wisdom, not more training. Not that I think that more training is a bad thing. I just don't see that it would have impacted the outcome a great deal in the cases that I've studied. With that said, I'm certainly not entirely opposed to it, but having read the document, I feel fairly strongly that we need to define what a high fidelity sim man training means. I think that needs to be in the definitions. I think that hours of a course need to be defined. ACLS is pretty strictly defined, but there's a great deal of variation that occurs in these sim man trainings. I think we really need to define what a sim man mannequin is, because they can span from $20,000 to $250,000 in price. So, you know, there's not that many courses that follow that description. There's probably not enough sim man courses in the state of Arizona to meet that need ultimately. And then lastly, I would just suggest that it be defined in such a way that private entities could also provide these sim man educations, much like private entities provide ACLS. Because there's going to be a huge need that's going to need to be met. It's not going to be simple to meet that need if that addendum is passed by the rules committee. So that was my commentary, and thank you.
Okay, thank you, Skip.
Go ahead. May I jump in real quick? I have a question for Skip Harris, because I think I want him to expand on something. So, Dr. Harris, there was a comment that you made, and I think that Seamus and I have also collaborated on the comment, and so maybe this is an opportunity again to ask, based on the comment that you made in the oral proceeding and the rules and the expectant start date, about when they would actually be fully in effect, which we don't know, but how would they affect the population of people that starts? Do you want to ask that question, and maybe Seamus can jump in and provide the legal advice on that?
Yes, thank you. I had forgotten we had that conversation. I think one of the concerns that I have as a permit holder who is about to expire and renew, I think these rules are going to land at a time, or potentially land at a time when it's going to give us a very short period of time to actually execute these new requirements. So in my case, if this were to say pass in June, I would have just a month or so to get this kind of stuff organized and done before I would be able to renew my permit. So I had the commentary that perhaps we should grandfather old permit holders through, or perhaps allow them to do it only on renewal starting, you know, the following year, so that everybody has a chance to have about a year to actually accomplish the new requirements. As opposed to scrambling to do it kind of at the last minute.
Jessica, did you want to ask a question or respond before Seamus responds to that?
Sure. I just had my hand raised. I just wanted to let you guys know, for what it's worth, there's always a 60-day effective date once you file the rules with the Secretary of State. So you've got 60 days there before they'll actually become effective. And that's just with a regular effective date. If the board wanted to, they can ask for a delayed effective date specifically to accommodate this sort of situation.
How much time can we get on a delayed effective date?
I'll let you talk to Seamus and I'll look it up for you. I don't know that there is a specific time limit. I mean, obviously you wouldn't want to go, you know, several years. I don't imagine that GERC would be happy with that. But let me check and see in statute if there's anything specific about how much you can delay them.
Okay. Skip?
I would simply point out that if you made the new requirements effective upon renewal and you didn't have it take effect until this batch that's coming up to renew, people would have a significant period of time to plan for the new requirements before they actually had to execute the renewal.
Seamus, are you on?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Dr. Hero. This is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. And, you know, I'm going to be brief here. You know, I think it's important for the board to understand that when a rule takes effect, it takes effect for everybody. You know, there may be a way to, you know, push off that effective date in which people have to comply. But there's also the practical effect, which, you know, the board will need to take into consideration. That practical effect is, are you in the middle of a renewal cycle? Have you not renewed yet? Are we requiring you to do things upon renewal that are now in the rule that weren't in the rule when you renewed last time? So we are going to have a significant gap. And again, you know, the board is just going to have to handle each complaint as it comes to them, which, you know, could be, hey, here we don't see a violation. And in another case, it could be based on the circumstances, you know, even though the implementation was ongoing, that, you know, we still find a violation. Again, it's hard to kind of game plan that out. But again, boards often deal with statutes and rules being implemented in the middle of people's renewal cycles. And what the board needs to take into consideration is, you know, is that individual attempting to comply with the law? Are they subject to the law right now or those requirements? And again, we will address those as they come up.
Thank you, Seamus. Jessica, and then we'll go to you, Addie.
So according to the statutes, there is no, you know, time restriction. If you want more than 60 days, then you can ask for more than 60 days for your effective date, so long as you have good cause and it's not going to harm your public interest.
Thank you. Go ahead, Addie. Mr. Diner, are you there?
You're muted, Mr. Diner.
Sorry, yes, yeah, thank you. Yeah, I would just thank you, Dr. Hero. I was saying I agree with what Mr. Monahan said. We can't have a different effective date based on renewal because it's like saying, you know, skim milk for some and vitamin D milk for some. If a rule goes into effect, it goes into effect for everybody. But I also want to make a larger point, you know, if you are going to discuss sort of each proposal as a board, this meeting can go on for, you know, more than 24 hours. So I just wanted to come back to Ryan's earlier comment that, you know, we take the comments into consideration and maybe vote on something or make a motion as the chair feels appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Ryan, do you want to comment on what you think an appropriate amount of time for a delayed effective date would be?
So I think that, and I hate substantive policies, but based on what Seamus had said and then Adi just kind of reiterated, some of it is practical effective date. You could do a substantive policy statement that the people that are renewing this year, it's not practical, especially if they go into effect. I'm not sure that they will go into effect this year, but let's just say that everything goes smoothly today. You could probably anticipate that the rules could be adopted even as early as July or August. So is that practical for people that are renewing this year to take the same course that Dr. Harris is talking about? Maybe not. So the people that are renewing this year, you could do a substantive policy statement. This could be at another board meeting to state that the new rules will affect you, but not until you renew the next time. But not in this course because it just got landed in their lap, in the 11th hour as they renewed this year. And so that's kind of how I think you could address it that way.
So this is something we can figure out, frankly, at a later time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, then let's move on. Jessica, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. So can everyone see my screen?
Yes.
You can make it a little bit bigger. That helps. Okay. So basically, I will go through where I see the comments applying, and then if there's something that I've missed, please feel free to stop me. The first comment that I have was for the definition of enteral. And I believe it was Dr. Caputo had a comment about the mucosa aspect of it by definition. That absorption through oral mucosa is by definition parenteral administration. So do we need to make a change to this, or we're happy with how it is?
Dr. Caputo, did you want to comment?
Sure, thank you. As Jessica mentioned, any drug absorbed through the oral mucosa bypasses the gastrointestinal tract. Therefore, it's a parenteral technique. So I would recommend that the board put a period after tract and delete or oral mucosa. Otherwise, effectively, the person who has an enteral permit is allowed to do parenteral administration, which is for a 1302 permit holder. So thank you.
Ryan, do you or board staff have a preference on if we vote as each edit comes up, or we take like all the definitions at once, like kind of by category?
Yeah, I think like if there's a multitude in definitions, then maybe do as long. I mean, the problem is going to be is if you have a split vote or not, it doesn't have to be unanimous, but it's split. But like, say Mr. Dinar has no issue with this definition change, but he's got an issue with another one, it'd be hard on the vote. So it may be, I don't know, Jessica, do you think it'd be better just to vote on each of these at this time?
That may be easier, Ryan. This is Seamus. Sorry, Jessica, just to
no, you're good.
Save you from having to answer an open meeting law question. it might be easier just to do them one at a time real quick.
Well, and I think for these definitions, it might be. And then once we get into the other sections, we can reevaluate. But I'll make a motion that we accept the edit that Dr. Caputo proposed.
Second. Dinar.
All in for discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Dr. Hero, this is Vicky Penn. I just joined the meeting.
Oh, great. Thanks for being here, Ms. Penn.
And Nick Goodman had a little bit of a challenge getting in, and he joined at 3:08.
Okay, great. Welcome. Any opposed on that last vote?
Okay. I'm going to oppose.
I'm sorry, Dr. Seaman?
I'm going to oppose. I had a question about the definitions there.
Sure.
So parenteral to me is like IV through a vein or something like that. An enteral is through the gastrointestinal tract, but neither of them really cover the mouth. So I'm just trying to figure out where we get one or the other is the mouth.
Well, first is we did have a vote and motion passed with one opposed.
Okay.
Dr. Caputo, do you want to answer Dr. Seaman's question?
Sure. It's just a matter of swallowing. So if you don't swallow a drug and it remains in your mouth and gets absorbed through the mucosa, it's now going to bypass the gastrointestinal tract. That's no longer enteral. It's parenteral.
So is parenteral anything other than enteral?
Parenteral is transdermal, rectal, intramuscular, intranasal, and inhalational, as well as intravenous.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you, doctors. Jessica, go ahead.
So the next one on the list is the definition of minimal sedation. And again, Dr. Caputo had a comment that the term appropriately should be changed to normally in order to be consistent with ADA guidelines.
Then I'll make a motion that we accept the edit as proposed by Dr. Caputo.
Christensen seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
Okay. And similarly, Dr. Caputo suggests changing the term modestly to mildly, because by definition, modestly infers a moderate change in vitals, which could imply moderate sedation levels.
This is Hero. I make a motion that we accept Dr. Caputo's recommendation.
Seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
Okay. That brings us then to the definition of Section 1301 permit. Oops.
Was that everything in definitions?
We're still in definitions.
Okay.
This is Christensen. Are we going to take all the comments in the various sections at a time? So we might have additional commenters on these on the definitions, and we'll just take these all right now.
Yeah, Eddie, my plan was to go section at a time. So if say we get through the end of the definitions, what I would do is ask, doctors Arnau, Fukami, and Snell if they had proposed edits in this section that were not mentioned. And if they did not, then we'd move forward.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Hero.
And also that we're not submitted during the comment period. Correct, right. Dr. Hero?
Right. Dr. Harris?
I just wanted to point out before we leave that section that I think a definition for high fidelity simulation man should be there as well.
Okay. Thank you, Dr.
So this comment was from, I believe, Dr. Snell, that we just need the term or after deep sedation.
I'll make a motion that we accept Dr. Snell's edit.
Christensen.
So we're in discussion. Dr. Caputo, did you have a comment?
I think it's actually before deep sedation. So it's general anesthesia or deep sedation.
Thank you. So Jessica, I think that's accurate.
So replace and with or?
Yes. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
Okay. And then we have another comment. Oh, yes. So Dr. Caputo and board staff identified that there was a typo, which I have already corrected. So this used to be an QAP. Correct is a QAP.
Great.
Change has already been made. Board doesn't need to do anything. All right. Anything else on definitions before we move on to a new section?
So I think you address Dr. Harris's comment. And then Dr. Ali, you put your hand up first. I'll have you go, and then Dr. Arnau.
Thanks. Let me lower my hand. Thanks, everyone, for allowing me to be here. I just noticed in the comments that came in, someone suggested referencing statute in the definition of QAP. I thought that was a good idea. I don't know if the board might want to. Somehow it didn't make it to this document, but in the emails and letters, someone had mentioned referencing statute for that definition.
So, Jessica, will you go to the definition of QAP? Or do we have that in rule, or is that only in statute?
Yeah, it's in here.
Oh, there we go.
There it is.
So, Ali, what's your suggestion?
I don't know what the steps, but to just reference the statute. So to say QAP means a qualified anesthesia provider per the appropriate statute.
Mr. Diner, did you have a comment?
Yes. So I'm looking at the definitions for Section 1301 permit, 1302, 1303, and they have inconsistencies in terms of where the or employ or work phrase is appearing. So I just wanted to make that consistent.
Okay. So before we move on to or move back to the or, so the suggestion was that we reference statute for the definition of qualified anesthesia provider.
And if I can interrupt, who made, I mean, other than Mr. Begay, what public comment was that? Because this is not going to be an open comment period to add new comments. Likely we're going to have another oral proceeding at another date, but we can't accept new comments today, so it has to be attributed to somebody that made that comment. Is that the, I'm not even sure. Is it ASDA's?
I'll find it. Give me one sec.
Okay.
Dr. Arnell and Dr. Fukami, you both have your hands up. Is it in, can you shed any light on the discussion we're having right now, or are your comments on an unrelated definition?
I can comment on that. I hope you guys can hear me okay. I'm finishing up a drive. My clinical day was a little bit longer than anticipated. Can you hear me okay?
We can. We can hear you real well, and we appreciate you being here.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, I was actually going to suggest the same thing that Ali suggested. And I do remember submitting this comment. I believe it may have been before the oral proceedings. But we have discussed this in the past, that QAP should either be defined or reference the statute, because the dentist who comes to this document to understand their responsibilities needs to have some way to find out what exactly a QAP is.
Yeah, that answers my question. It is Dr. Arnall that made the comment.
Go ahead, Jessica.
So I do recall having this conversation as we were going through these rules. I don't think it was, I don't know if it was made during the oral comment period or if someone had put this particular comment in one of their written comments that they submitted during the official comment period. But for what it's worth, qualified anesthesia provider is already defined in statute. And those statutory definitions are already referenced at the beginning of your rule definitions. It says that all of the definitions in 32.1201 apply in addition to what you're putting into rule right now. So qualified anesthesia provider is already defined in 32.1201, which is already referenced by the entire definition section of this rule. So I'm not saying you don't necessarily can't put it in the actual QAP section. I just don't think that it's necessary.
I would agree with you, Jessica.
Thank you, Seamus.
With this being a new term and kind of a foundational term with these edits, personally, I would like it included in this definition. I think it's just going to provide better clarity. As long as we're not unable to do that, Jessica, so that you're saying we can, but we don't have to. Is that correct?
Yeah. I can understand how it would be helpful to folks who are reading this. I mean, from a rule, you know, standpoint, I would say no, just because it makes it more redundant because it's already been listed, but I can understand why, you know, on the professional side of things, you want to have it in there.
This is great.
Well, I'll make a motion that we that we accept this edit and include it, and we'll just see what the board thinks.
Christensen, right. Seconds.
Great. Sherry, let's have a roll call.
1 second. I had to unclick. Sorry. Hero?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Ben?
Yes.
Denar?
Denar?
No.
No.
Goodman? Goodman? Carmo?
Carmo?
Yes.
Yes.
Morrow?
Morrow?
Yes.
Yes.
Pena? Pena?
Yes.
Seaman?
No.
Motion passes, 2 opposed. Dr. Arnell, your hand is up. Did you have a separate comment?
No, I don't. Thank you very much.
Dr. Fukami, your hand was up and now gone. Did you have a comment?
No longer. Someone already explained. I had actually included that comment in my own notes as well.
Now, how about Dr. Harris's comment about including a definition for high fidelity simulation? Jessica, did you have any thought on that?
So your definition section should define terms that are used specially. So if it's a common definition, you don't need to define it because common usage of that term will prevail. If it's a special term that you're using or that you're using in a way that isn't commonly used, then that's when you want to put it in your definition. I'm not sure what rule is being referred to that would require a definition of that particular term, if that makes sense.
Yes. Dr. Caputo.
Thank you. I might also just point out that under 1302, that term is not there. I don't know if it was the committee's intention to indicate high fidelity human simulation for a 1301 permit holder and just human simulation for a 1302 permit holder. But I think that is, to Dr. Harris's point, that if there is agreement to even make that a requirement, it probably is special enough to be defined, so that there's direction on where one might get that type of training to meet that rules requirement. Thank you.
Seamus.
Thank you, Dr. Hero. Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. I just wanted to say that if the board potentially sees this as a term of art that will come up later in cases and potentially formal hearings, then it would be helpful to have that defined. If the board believes that it can define that, otherwise it will leave it open to other definitions, excuse me. Thank you.
Dr. Arnell, not to put you on the spot, but do you have any thoughts on this?
I think our discussion is evidence that we need a definition. Even in our discussion now, you know, it's hard to nail down what exactly high fidelity human simulation is. And I think it will be hard for a lot of, you know, we have to think about the end user. The end user is the dentist going to this document to seek direction. And if they don't understand the term, they'll contact the board repeatedly. I have a feeling if you don't define it, the board will constantly get letters asked or emails asking for clarification.
Okay, great. So Jessica, why don't we define it with the help of some of the specialists we have on line right now?
Do you want to define it now with the specialists, or do you want to make a note that we need to define it, and then we can have a meeting later to actually hash out what it should mean?
That's probably fine.
Yeah, and okay. I think that it may not have been part of a public comment, so to change this document now, I think it'll have to come in the next oral proceeding.
Okay. Then we can move on to the next section, I think. Mr. Diner.
Dr. Hero, you skipped my thing that relates to the Snell comment regarding Section 1301 permit.
You're right.
The changes that we make, that just needs to be consistent, 1301, 1302, and 1303.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
No, you're fine.
Is that something we need to vote on?
Yes, please.
Okay. Addie, do you want to make a motion then?
Yeah, I'll make a motion to accept the edits to 1301 and make the same changes to 1302 and 1303 to make those three definitions consistent.
Terrible second.
Terrible second.
All in favor?
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, not opposed.
So just to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly, we had already made the determination to change and to or. And then you mentioned doing the same thing in 1302 and 1303. Is that?
Well, so there's the other or that's coming from 1303, which is before employ. And that makes sense to me, but it's not appearing in 1302 and 1301.
So thank you for clarifying, because that's where I was confused as well. The comment that I saw suggested putting the word before employ. So it would go here. And then when we talked about it, it was said that this and should actually be before as well. So those are two different things.
Dr.
Right,
Snow.
Very different things, and that's why, yep.
Okay.
Dr. Snell?
I was just going to clarify what Jessica just said. My initial comment was exactly what she's doing there, because it was inconsistent with the way 1303 was written. So I think Jessica's doing what I had suggested initially.
So then my question is, changing the and to an or does not sound like it was part of the original written comments.
That's on my end that I made the initial comment. There was no comment to change that word and.
So the board's already voted to accept changing and to or. Does the board want to, I mean, we can do this two ways. If you want, you can change that. We can make it a separate comment that's addressed at a later date because it wasn't included in the written comments, or I guess not or, but do we need to also change it everywhere that anesthesia and deep sedation applies? Or are there going to be circumstances where it should be an or and circumstances where it should be an and? And if that's the case, then this is a longer conversation.
Dr. Caputo or Dr. Arnell, do you want to comment?
I would say that Jessica's last point was correct. I think you just have to look at when it is incorporated. So it may be that or could be the overriding term. I think it's also something that you could generally accept that you can't provide both. So generally speaking, you're going to provide one level or the other. So it may be that it doesn't need to be changed at all. So there is a contextual issue there. And it may be a non-issue by virtue of that my comment as well. So thank you.
I believe either way, people will understand the intent. So I think it will be okay either way.
Okay, hearing that, Jessica, then what do you recommend?
If you guys don't have a preference, whether it's and or, then I would say leave it as is.
And then we should motion to accept the change with the or after deep sedation, correct?
Correct. And I'll leave it up to Seamus, but you may want to do something to revote or revoke the vote that you made to change the and to an or.
Seamus, you want us to rescind that previous motion or just leave that alone and add the new or?
Yeah, I think you would need to. Thank you, Dr. Hero. I'm just listening to what you're saying. And, you know, I just want to make sure we're considering general anesthesia and deep sedation the same thing, because that's what I read right now. So as long as we consider it the same thing, I don't want to throw a wrench into this, but again, that's just the issue I see. The way I see it written right now, general anesthesia and deep sedation are written as the same thing. And I don't know, maybe I defer to member Dinar and, you know, what he thinks about the construction of this rule. But again, you know, I just want to make sure that at the end of the day, we are clear that general anesthesia and deep sedation are two different things.
Yeah, I don't have anything intelligent to say, Seamus, other than, I mean, yeah, and makes sense to me, but or between deep sedation and general anesthesia also makes sense to me. I mean, it is essentially on the 1301 permit, you can do one, you can either do general anesthesia or deep sedation, but in the definition section, we are saying if you have, a 1301 permit means that you're permitted to administer these two things. So, and makes sense to my mind. I could argue both ways, but you know, I've already spent more time on this than I care about it.
Well, Mr. Dinar, you said it right there. You could argue both ways. That's my issue. Just kidding.
Yeah. No,
again, I'll leave that up to the board, though. I don't think we need to make, you know, a massive issue if the board thinks this is clear.
Dr. Blazek.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell you, Anthony, I'm sorry to butt in. I didn't have any comment, but it is the same. It is the same. I think any professional on this call that provides anesthesia will tell you deep sedation and general anesthesia are the same thing. And the 1301 permit is the only permit holder that's allowed to do those two levels of anesthesia.
Thank you, doctor. So then, Jessica, I'll just make a motion that we add the or after deep sedation per Dr. Snell's comment.
Sounds good.
Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Morrow.
All in favor?
All in favor.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries, none opposed. Okay, Jessica.
And Dr. Hero, sorry, but in the definition section, we have separate definitions for deep sedation and general anesthesia. And I think that's why those two terms need to be in there. But I think that's a totally different conversation. You know, if those two terms are the same thing, then do we just need to make the entire rules consistent with just one term instead of using two terms in two different contexts? And if you are using two different terms, then what is the difference between general anesthesia and deep sedation? As a public member, I would get confused. Maybe dentists won't, but just flagging it.
Thank you. Are you okay if we just put a pin in that and move on?
Yes.
Okay.
Anything else on definitions before we move on to another section?
It doesn't appear so.
Okay. The next comment that we have, I believe, is in Rule 406. And Dr. Caputo questions why are fees decreased for 1302 and 1303 permit holders, particularly when 1302 permits essentially have the same evaluation requirements as a 1301 permit.
So the intent behind that was that 1301 is still going to be every 3 years, where 1302 is longer than that. So I think that was the difference in fees. Dr. Arnell?
I believe I understood what you're saying, but I think you switched the numbers, right? 1301 is more expensive, but it goes 5 years. 1302 is less expensive, but it goes 3 years.
Yeah, but I thought the committee, I thought we had that flipped. I thought 1301 was going to have, we were keeping it as every 3 years, but we had a longer period of time for 1302.
1301 has been 5 years for a long time.
Oh, it has been, yeah.
Well, and I think that the renewal period was decreasing from 5 to 3.
That's what I thought. And I thought it had to do with the oromaxillofacial board certification, having to have it done within a certain time frame. Dr. Christensen or Dr. Blazek, could you comment on that?
I was going to defer to Eddie, but no, the OMFS examination for recertification is 5 years. It's not three. So that hasn't changed for us. But my memory, I thought we were going to drop it in the state of Arizona due to the pediatric, maybe it has something with the pediatric designation. It's been a while, Dr. Hero, so it's hard for me to remember. But I thought they were staying, you know, staying the same. But maybe that's the confusion, the conversation about the pediatric designation.
That was this is Christensen. That was my understanding too, Dr. Hero, but it's been a little while since we broached that.
So what I thought the conversation was about was expanding them to 6 years. And the reason we weren't going to do that for 1301 was because of the surgery board certification had to be 5 years or less. And then
that is correct.
Yeah. Right. And then the 02 and the 03, because we were trying to get everything, we were trying to get the triennial certification, the pediatric endorsement, and the sedation permit all to coincide like every 3 years on the licensee's birthday. So it was just one date for them to track everything. Dr. Arnell, you got your hand up?
I believe that was my mistake. I apologize.
Dr. Snell?
Thank you, Dr. Hero. What you just said is what was my recommendation conversation between you and I, was that we wanted to line everything up with the triennial, but the OMFS having their board certification, that was going to be the one-off. And so the O2s and the O3s would be on a three-year cycle, and therefore the amount is still $60 a year in a sense. It's just every 3 years, and the OMF is going to be 5 years, so there's a 60 a year, thus the 300.
Okay. Seamus.
And I, please don't take this as me trying to stifle any conversation. But I am hearing, you know, some, you know, I think this or I remember this, you know, and so I just want to make sure that we are sticking to what the actual comments are and, you know, what the language of the last document coming out of the committee was. So, you know, I just want to make sure we're remembering that.
Okay. So Jessica, I don't think there's a proposed edit here. It was a question. And it seems like the response is that they're based on the renewal period. So given that, maybe we can just move on.
Okay. So the next comment that I have is on 1203 and changing 63 credit hours to 72 credit hours. And the question was, why was it increased? And if it wasn't supposed to be increased, then that may be an oversight, because so for those of you who were frustrated with what happened between the last anesthesia and sedation meeting versus what was filed with the Secretary of State. A lot of that was based on the fact that the board had also been working on additional rulemakings at the same time, specifically related to continuing education credits. And so what may have happened is that the board, as it was working on anesthesia and sedation, was not taking into account previous changes or concurrent changes that were happening to the same rules that had not quite yet gone into effect when you were doing your edits, but had gone into effect as of filing with the Secretary of State. So if this should not be 72 hours, then we can put it back to 63 or put it back to whatever you think it's supposed to be. But based on my understanding of where we were on individual rulemakings that were affecting the same rule, that's where it ended up.
Dr. Caputo.
Well, it's my understanding that the hours were decreased for licensees. Is that right, Brian?
Yeah, it should be 63. It is a base text issue, Jessica.
And I think that I made this point is I really truly want each board member to understand, as we're going to go into a discussion later about CE requirements for permitting, if you are comfortable, which I hope you are, with decreasing CE requirements for dentists, then that mindset is pertinent to some issues we're going to discuss later with regards to CE requirements for permit levels. Thank you.
So what I'm hearing is that this should not be 72 hours. It should stay at 63.
Correct. Yeah. It is one of those things, Jessica. It's a base text issue, and it should stay at 63.
Okay.
Which is the way it currently reads in the register, SOS register.
Mr. Begay.
Thanks. I just had a question on this regarding what we were talking about a moment ago with the renewal periods. So someone who renews every 5 years will have to do 63 hours, as well as someone who renews every 3 years will have to do 63 hours?
Unless this is a question that the board needs to clarify, this isn't really the forum for the board to be answering questions. However, to your point, Mr. Begay, if the board does have an issue with that, then feel free to enter into that, you know, conversation. But again, this isn't the opportunity to ask questions that aren't related to public comment.
I apologize for not noticing before.
Ms. Reiner.
Apology necessary.
So yeah, I think it's a base text issue. The rule says 63, but then the question is the math adding up, because 36 becomes 42, 15 becomes 18, and the other changes, where are those changes coming from? So, you know, I agree with the staff's comment about the 63 versus 72 being a base text issue. But then I have a further question based on that.
And these, Ryan, I mean, the 63 hours it's talking about, this is for every licensee. This isn't specific to permit holders.
Correct.
Yeah. Mr. Donner, did you have another question or comment?
No, I was agreeing with you. That's correct. This is applicable for everybody.
Okay. Dr. Seaman?
My recollection is we moved it down to 63 because we did a review of all the other boards in the country, and they were all, we had one of the more higher CE requirements, and so we moved it down, and it was 63 and then 36 and whatever that last one is.
Yeah, you're yeah. Absolutely right.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, so for Jessica, just for edification purposes, the 36 should remain also, to go along with Mr. Dinar's comment, not 42. Number the next section down, subsection down to should be 15 versus 18. Yep. And then I think the rest is, remains correct. Yeah, it does. Everything else is 3, 3, 3.
Anything else on 1203 before we move on to another section?
I think we can move on, Jessica.
Okay. Did I skip one? Oh, yes, I did. Okay. Sorry. I have another comment for 1203. One of the written comments was from the, I believe it was Health and Safety Institute. And they had, from what I recall, the same comment on several sections relating to the basic life support and the American Heart Association. Their comment was basically that there is a monopoly being created if the board is only allowing these credits to be received or earned at the American Heart Association versus any of the other agencies that provide this sort of service or this sort of certification. My comment is that if we added in the language that they suggest, which is for another agency that follows the same procedures, standards, and techniques for training as the American Heart Association, just from a rule writing standpoint, the question then becomes, who makes that determination? Is it the board? Is it staff on a one-off basis? If it's not the American Heart Association, then you have to go and compare whatever organization it is to the standards and training that is provided by the American Heart Association. The issue is really that becomes pretty burdensome on the board and board staff, unless there's another entity out there that does this type of comparison to make sure that the, you know, Joe's CPR class down the street is meeting the same standards and procedures and techniques that are being certified by the American Heart Association.
So my question would be, for Ryan or Jessica, in the other areas of rules where we discuss continuing education, do we specify that CE has to be endorsed by a certain agency?
So my personal opinion is to keep it, and I wasn't sure I was going to get asked this, but I would keep it the way it reads now, as opposed to accepting HSI's comment, and not because I'm opposed to HSI or any other agency that does something like this, but to Jessica's point, if it's so general in terms like what they provided in their written comments, you could have anybody in a fly-by-night situation and somebody that needs to get renewed literally be saying that, oh, they provided this course, you know, like within the last 10 minutes, and because it fits the general definition, then the board should accept it. Or the board gets inundated with multiple people teaching this course and trying to approve courses. And the general sense is just not good. So I think you either stick with one, add a couple that you like to Jessica's point, but don't do it in such general terms that anybody and everybody in a mom-pop situation can just provide this type of an education.
I guess where my thought was going is if you just eliminated endorsed by and whatever institution follows that, wouldn't it by default go to recognize continuing dental education, that definition? So if you have to take basic life support, it has to be recognized continuing dental education. It has to fit within that definition.
And I don't want to speak for Ryan, but I believe that's what the rule is trying to define. You know, I think that is exactly the point. so maybe the question is, you know, Is it easy to be endorsed by the American Heart Association? Are there other, you know, groups like the American Heart Association that the board should be considering, that also endorse or accredit these courses? Or is there a accreditor of these, actual courses other than just being endorsed? But those are just things to think about.
Jessica.
So I don't know if there's someone here from the Health Safety Institute, but I believe that they provided some additional documentation besides their comments that supported their comments, one of which I believe was a letter from, I want to say 2007 or 2003 maybe, that talked about how the American Heart Association does not endorse anything other than their own stuff.
Thank you, Jessica. Mr. Dinar.
So I just want to point out that this change in this particular section comes because we are deleting American Heart Association from everywhere else. So if you just look for American Heart Association in our rules packet, you'll see like 7 or 8 places where we had mentioned that. So this isn't so much a new thing as it's an old thing that we are taking from some other place and putting it in a section that makes the most sense. So this isn't a substantive rule change. I would be in favor of keeping it as it is. And we consider the comment and we reject deleting it.
Is that a motion?
I'll make it a motion.
I'll second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
I tried to unmute, but I'm aye as well.
Motion carries, not opposed.
Okay, now anything else on 1203 before we go on to 1301?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right, so we have a comment on number 2, so B2. And this is from Dr. Caputo. Consider incorporating language to state the permit holder maintains an action plan for the conduct of any sedation or anesthesia procedure that includes appropriate drugs, equipment, and supplies accepted according to state and national standards such as AAOMS and ASDA. And then I believe he provided examples to the Southwest Dental Association policies and procedures.
Dr. Caputo, do you want to comment on this?
Sure, thank you. And just for clarification, Southwest Dental Anesthesia Services is my private practice. And what I provided to the board for reference was an action plan that I have developed and utilized in my own practice. My comment here actually supports a comment that Dr. Smell made about drugs with respect to a paralytic. One of the issues that has not been discussed for several years, and we see it incorporated more and more in practices, is the use of volatile agents and then having a malignant hypothermia plan in place in the event that that occurs during the administration of volatile agents or other triggering agents. And so instead of listing things specifically as we do here, my proposal to the board, which I think would make this more efficient, is require an action plan that the permit holder would have to provide or at least have put together and documented. And this would then also translate to all permit levels, that in the event that there was a issue or has been referenced before by Seamus, a complaint or an incident, and the board was doing its reviews, one of the things that it would request from the dentist is their action plan. And that action plan would be reviewed and referenced as a way of saying, okay, were you following your action plan versus the rules trying to have to encompass every single possibility of sedation or anesthesia administration. There are many ways to do this, as we know. So I'm not a big fan of lists generally. And so my proposal is eliminating this list and requesting that the permit holder actually have an action plan in place for their particular technique or techniques of administering sedation or anesthesia in their practice. And so I gave you, again, my example of what I use in my practice for reference. Thank you.
Any thoughts on Dr. Caputo's comments? You know, I like what you're saying, Anthony. It's a pretty big deviation from where we are right now, and I feel like that wasn't really fleshed out before, so I'm a little hesitant to move forward with that edit yet. That's where my head's at right now. Mr. Diner?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a best practice thing. It's not a rule thing. People are free to get, you know, develop an action plan if they want to under the rules that we have.
Then I'll make a motion that we reject that edit.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? I mean, yeah, opposed. Motion carries, none opposed.
Okay, that brings us then to next comment. A neuromuscular blocker such as,
succinylcholine,
okay, was omitted from the list of emergency medications for general anesthesia, should absolutely be included for treatment of. And you guys just said this word.
Laryngospasm.
Laryngospasm, thank you. Also would recommend anti-hypoglycemic like IV dextrose.
I don't remember why succinylcholine was removed from the, I mean, wasn't that originally on here? I see Dr. Caputo shaking his head, yes. Dr. Arnell?
It got removed during one of our committee sessions. We found that it was written better in 1302. So we copied and pasted it from 1302 into 1301, then made a few edits to make it match. But we forgot that in 1302, we wouldn't recommend them having a paralytic, whereas in 1301, we would. So that's how it got omitted. It originally was in there. It's been in there for years, but it, just in editing the document, it accidentally was omitted.
Dr. Snell.
Yes, I think what Dr. Snell did, it's, well, I don't think I know. It was been in there forever. It's been in all of them, or I shouldn't say all of them. I know it's been in 1301 and 1302, maybe 1802, which I think is appropriate and it should stay removed. But for 1301, and my comment is in the same section, that it just got copied from 1302, but it should be put back into the 1301 section because they are doing general anesthesia and deep sedation.
Then I'll make a motion that we accept the portion of the edit that recommends we insert succinylcholine into the list of drugs, but reject the edit regarding the IV dextrose.
Christians and seconds.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
This is Jessica. Just so that so one of the things that I'm doing is I'm making sure that you're addressing all of your comments, because that's part of what has to go into the ultimate rule package that goes to GERC. So, I don't know that you guys discussed it and maybe I just missed it, but can you explain or give me a response as to why you are not including the dextrose?
My reason for not including it is it's never been discussed until right now. I don't feel, the committee didn't discuss it. The board hadn't discussed it. So I just don't feel comfortable adding in a medication without having a more robust opinion on it. Mr. Bagai.
Thanks. Just to the succinylcholine piece, thought, we have classes of drugs listed, so I would just recommend it saying a neuromuscular blocker as opposed to succinylcholine specifically. These days you could have rocuronium with sugammadex to reverse laryngospasm without risk of malignant hyperthermia. So that would just be my one suggestion, is to not specify succinylcholine but use that class of drugs.
So I believe the board just motioned to add in the specific neuromuscular blocker. Do you want me to add in just a neuromuscular blocker instead of naming the particular drug?
I would want to hear from some of our 1301 permit holders.
Fine with me.
Dr. Vukami?
Oh, same. Neuromuscular blocker, I think, was the intent.
Okay. And as this was Dr. Vukami's original comment, then I'll amend my motion to reflect the discussion that we're having right now.
Do we have an amended second?
Morrow seconds that. Oh, it wasn't me that seconded it.
That's okay. Do you amend it? Do you second the amended motion?
I second the amended motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries and opposed.
Okay, that brings us to our next comment. Snell questions whether or not the list of emergency drugs should include a muscle paralytic. That's the same as Dr. Fukami, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right, then we will move on. Just two misspellings, so we'll fix those. I don't think we need to discuss them. That brings us then to number 6. Oh yeah, same comment, okay. We've already gone over that. I believe there was a question. Dr. Caputo comments that B6 is not necessary and no documented research or literature to demonstrate improvement to or benefit for patient safety.
I know the committee spent a length of time discussing this, and I think they unanimously voted on including the high fidelity human simulation. So I would probably defer to that recommendation. And Dr. Harris, go ahead.
Sorry to chime in, but I would just submit to you that I can't think of a single adverse event I've reviewed over the years that would have been affected by the person having had this additional training. So I would just throw out that if we're going to have additional training, we need to make sure it's obtainable, that it's defined clearly, and that it has a clear benefit.
And with this being a 1301 permit, I mean, I would defer to the 1301 permit holders. So I don't know. I mean, Dr. Arnall, Dr. Christensen, Dr. Fukami, do you want to comment?
I'll make a comment. I feel that as years go by, we add more and more to our rules. And my personal thought is that we don't need to add this to our rules. Although the committee did vote for this. So out of principle, I would stand by the committee, but personally, I don't think it's a good idea to add, you know, continually add these things to rule. The rule should cover the minimum boundaries that the law allows, as opposed to trying to cover everything we can think of.
Dr. Christensen or Dr. Blazek, do you have a comment?
No, I really don't, Anthony. I think it's fine the way that they've discussed it. This is Blazek.
Christensen, it's fine.
Eddie, fine to leave in, or you're comfortable taking it out? I hate to put you on the spot. I just, you know, you guys are the 1301 permit holders, so your insight on this, I think, is most valuable. Ryan?
If I can, and I don't want to speak for Dr. Harris, but this is exactly what he was referring to at the very beginning of the meeting today about this SIM course. And additionally, if I can add, this has to go through GIRC. Anybody that's ever attended GIRC will know that they generally don't add stuff to or don't want to see stuff that adds a layer of burden to the profession. So no matter what, at some point when this goes to GIRC, even though we have an oral proceeding and have an open comment period, they have basically the same thing when it goes to the study session. And so people will get another bite of the apple. And if that same comment is heard in GIRC, they're likely to erase 6 anyway. So if there's not enough evidence to support it, this may be the time to remove it, or maybe amend it or soften it or something to where it doesn't look like a burden, because it likely could get erased anyway through that the study session at GIRC. That's just from an administrative view.
Dr. Fukami.
I guess I'm trying to figure out where the support came for this measure in committee. I can see good reasons for it. I'm wondering if there's a way to preserve this notion of high fidelity simulation in the component of going towards, for example, permit renewal process, to substitute for something in that way. But I will point out that I thought that perhaps the other oral surgeons on the committee may be able to comment on this better, but I think AMIS actually has begun to impose a requirement for simulation within amongst their members as well. So I think that might have been the genesis for some of this and might be consistent with their need to preserve it within the language of these regulations. But otherwise that is what I wanted to hear about is if there was a structure by which it can be introduced that doesn't require it, but rather can be incorporated into renewal CE.
Thank you, Dr. Fukami. Dr. Blazek.
Yeah, so I guess my point of view on this and why I'm kind of backing off our original recommendations is I see this as a big stall point for the board, not so much for the committee. The committee seemed to all be on board with this idea for high fidelity simulation. It did come through Amos. So you know what? It's a requirement for me to have it. I'm going to do it. I thought in good faith that was probably a good idea for us to incorporate it into the new statutes and why we recommended it in committee. If it's coming to the board and the board is looking at it as, well, this is going to really delay this getting through or delay this getting passed, I think in Eddie and I, Dr. Christensen and I, point of view is like, then fine, take it out. That's on you. That's on the board and it's on the other individuals. Dr. Christensen and I, we will still do high fidelity simulation. It passed at the national level for the American Association of Maxillofacial Surgeons. And what they did is they went in and they vetted certain simulation courses and they say, here are the simulation courses that we feel are acceptable. And if you pass one of these every 5 years, then you will still maintain your board certification. So that's kind of the history and the background on it. But I'm not going to be so strong-headed on it, I think, is my point, Dr. Hero, that the board wastes another 45 minutes belaboring this issue, because I just think we've got to move on and get through it. That would be why I just acquiesced, I would say.
I'm going to make a motion then that we where's the comment, Jessica, about removing this? Dr. Caputo's comment, unnecessary. So I make a motion that we accept Dr. Caputo's recommendation and remove number 6.
This is Christensen. I'll go ahead and second that. To the point of now we're in discussion, I would agree with Dr. Blazek's comments. I don't think we could say it any better as a specialty in oral and maxillofacial surgery. It's a requirement for us to have that. And, you know, we're going to continue to do that as board certified oral and maxillofacial surgeons.
Jessica.
So if we are removing number 6 completely, then we don't need to have any further discussion about high fidelity human simulation definitions,
correct,
nor do we need to discuss changing 5 years to 6 years.
Correct.
Just to clarify. Okay. And again, to clarify, the board is determining to remove this section because they agree that it is not necessary?
Correct.
Okay.
Sherry, let's get a roll call on this.
Hero?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Dinar?
Yes, and for the additional reason that I view Section 6 as a new permanent condition for women.
Goodman?
Yes.
Carmo?
Yes.
Morrow?
Yes.
Hannah? Yes. Hannah? Seaman?
Yes.
Motion carries, none opposed.
So that brings us then to subsection D. And Dr. Caputo commented, there's no area of general dentistry or specialty that requires a minimal number of procedures to maintain performance. There is no data or other information that supports minimum procedures improve patient safety. The critical issues are decision-making and patient selection, similar to the number of pediatric cases requirement. The continuing education requirements for the pediatric endorsement should be allowed to apply towards the total CE requirements for renewal, though consider an adjustment such as 15 instead of 20.
Jessica, can you scroll down? Where does it talk about the CE requirements? Because I agree with Dr. Caputo on this, and honestly, I think it was the intent of the committee to have the CE requirements, the CE that the licensee takes for the pediatric endorsement, to also count towards your general requirements. I can't say for sure that was the intent, but I think that was my understanding of it. So, go ahead, Dr. Blazek.
That was the intent.
Okay. And I think that this is another issue in 1303. I don't know about 02, but Dr. Caputo, do you want to talk on this point?
I'm just going to echo what Dr. Harris started off his comments with. At the end of the day, folks, we are looking at licensees who make poor decisions. And the poor decisions that they make are, to echo his word, a matter of hubris more than they are anything else. And I would just like all of you to consider the times you have interviewed or spoken with dentists about the bad decisions that they made, and none of this stuff ever comes up. And sometimes we even scratch our head making recommendations about more CE when we know maybe that's not the answer. And I know even from a public perspective, that gets scrutinized, is that, oh, you only did this, was requiring CE. CE is good, and I think Dr. Fukami made a great comment about that. We should support CE. And we should support CEs through renewal and whatnot, that is appropriate. But I will also echo what I said earlier. This board approved the decrease in a dentist's renewal requirements for their CE. So why are we asking for an increase in CE? Why are we doing things that are above and beyond when we know that that's not the heart of the matter? Yes, we should support CE. We know that has a place, but I don't think it should be excessive. And I don't think it makes anybody safer. And so this will come up again, as you said, Dr. Hero. This is in other sections as well. I think that for the pediatric endorsement, while I understand the intent of the committee, at the end of the day, folks, if you look at the adverse events, and Dr. Harris, I would ask him to tell me if I'm wrong in saying this, but when we have adverse events, they're with adults. They're not with kids. And so, yes, we want to protect all of our patients, and I do think children are important, but our adult patients are the ones that are getting in trouble. So if we're going to have this pediatric endorsement, which I think is here, and I'm not arguing that, let's just make it practical and appropriate. Let's allow CE that's directed towards the pediatric endorsement to be included in the overall CE requirement for that permit level, and not make it additional to. And I'm not going to fight on the patient experience thing. I just don't agree with it. But I know that's something that's been around, and it's a fight I'll save for another day. But I certainly want to emphasize to the committee to really consider how we're doing these CE requirements and make them more appropriate and consistent across permit levels. Thank you.
Dr. Harris?
Just to reiterate, I can't think of a single pediatric adverse event that I've studied that I thought to myself, oh, if this person had only been seeing more pediatric patients, it would have been a different outcome. So I think that bare minimum number is somewhat abstract, and I'm not sure I see that many kids that are under 8 years old to meet that requirement just in regular practice.
Dr. Blazek.
So, I kind of have a comment from two points of view, Dr. Hero. And one would be maybe three points of view. I really respect Dr. Caputo and Dr. Harris and all that they've done for
anesthesia and the world of dentistry in this state for many years, many more than the 4 years that I've sat on this committee. And, you know, they've done the lion's share of the work, back when these statutes, were reviewed, back in, late 2000s and, you know, 2010 and thereafter, when they got passed in that time frame. But I would respectfully request the board to also understand that this anesthesia subcommittee has been hard at work for 4 years. We put a lot of effort and diligence into making these recommendations. And I think that at the nth hour, to be an armchair quarterback and come in and try to modify or change what a lot of people on the committee put a lot of thought into, is difficult to swallow as a committee member. That being said, I would also ask or defer to my anesthesia colleagues, Bukami, Dr. Harris, Dr. Caputo, Dr. Arnell, and I don't disagree that the number of CE or the number of patients doesn't make you a good provider, but how does the board possibly monitor or oversee someone's anesthesia permit having no clue as to, one, where's anesthesia being provided? That was a big issue that we think we've dealt with. Two, who's providing the anesthesia, meaning how are they being permitted? What's their training? What's their background? And three, how are they maintaining proficiency? And I think if you don't at least say, man, they are going to CE and man, they are doing 15, 20 cases every couple of years, the board has no way to even say like, yep, we put our stamp approval on this person and we know that at least they're maintaining proficiency through CE and administering anesthetics.
Thank you, Dr. Blazek. Dr. Fukami.
Thank you. I appreciate everyone's comments on this one. So this is one that I actually would disagree with some of the comments that have been made as well. Skip, I actually know of some cases where the it was indeed a situation where children were harmed primarily because the practitioner was the in their individual practice was not actually providing care for that level or age level on regularly. And in fact, I wouldn't even say it was less than 10 a year. It was probably that this was the first time that they'd actually taken care of a child, perhaps in the last couple of years. And so I think that, unfortunately, while these events aren't as common as perhaps some of the other ones that we've been seeing, that they are catastrophic, that they are avoidable, and they are informative, because I think that they can at least shed light on the fact that at least in some of these cases, that event could have been prevented if that practitioner had some experience in treating that age group. Children are not the same as adults. I think pediatric anesthesia is not the same as adult anesthesia. And that's not to say that one is more dangerous than the other. They're just oftentimes different. And the best way to recognize that in some ways, if we aren't going to rely solely on training, is also to incorporate the aspect that experience within that age group does count for something. And so I think that it is important to preserve the notion of a pediatric endorsement that incorporates case experiences within that. I don't think the original comments that were being made here were necessarily to reduce or remove that case experience aspect here. So I don't think that that's what was being said, but I just want to reinforce that in case that it was. And then regarding the notion of CE in pediatric anesthesia, anatomy, et cetera, if it sounds to me like this is going to be incorporated within the total anesthesia CE that we required for renewal, if that is indeed what has been both proposed and can be incorporated into this document, I have no reason to be concerned otherwise.
Great. And I appreciate the comments, Dr. Fukami. I'm going to get to Dr. Lout next and then Dr. Morrow. I do want to kind of bring this back around. And frankly, Dr. Fukami kind of did that for me in the end, where I think what we're talking about right now is editing the language, not on caseload, but just so that the CE hours that are taken to obtain the pediatric endorsement also count towards the general requirement of the permit. So Jessica, we're going to need your help in how to modify the language to accomplish that. But let's start bringing it back around so we can do that and move forward. Dr. Lau, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Hero. In the early days of the committee, I know one of our charges were for to have like a pediatric endorsement and have some things for our pediatric population. I kind of echo what Dr. Fukami has just said. We're lucky in the state of Arizona that we really have not had a lot of issues with oral sedation in children or IV GA. I think credit goes to the people in Arizona. Also, credit goes to the evaluators that go out and check the offices or the practitioner. So I think a lot of that. I'm not opposed to the continuing education as well. I kind of agree with everybody with that. I do advocate the case experience. I think that people have to have experience in these things. We had a pediatric anesthesiologist on the committee, Dr. I'm drawing a blank now.
Jermaine.
There you go. Thank you, Jermaine. And I think that the cases is I advocate for that and I advocate for the experience, but also I advocate for continuity of care. You know, somebody shouldn't treat like a 3-year-old every 2 years and not have a 3 or 4-year-old and have familiarity in treating that patient with oral sedation or general or IV sedation. So that's my thought on the process. And that's just kind of the evolution of the committee, how it's progressed with these kind of thoughts and these kind of actions over the 4 years.
Thank you, Dr. Lau. Dr. Mara, did you have a comment?
I do. I'm glad you had Dr. Lau go first because I was going to have him go before me anyway because I wanted to hear what he had to say from a pediatric standpoint. Now, I'm not an IV sedation user. Typically, I bring in a nurse anesthetist a lot. So what I'm going to talk about is from a political standpoint is that the cases that I remember most are the kids that have died that have come before the dental board. So, you know, we've had multiple adults that have had passed, and tragic as it is, the ones that stay with me are the kids. And if we serve at the behest of the governor, and we have to make sure we protect legally the governor, if we were to take this out of the rulemaking and then say 6 months from now, something happens to a kid because of exactly this thing, it could be bad on the dental community. It could be bad on the governor. It could be bad on the dental board to show that we decreased the permits and then therefore had an adverse effect that would have taken care of through this. So I'm in disagreement to taking anything out. I also, when I bring in a nurse anesthetist to put to sleep, they bring in two. They bring two nurse anesthetists, to take extra precaution. So, I'm all for making sure that we keep the tone of keeping our kids safe. They're the youngest and the most vulnerable of our population. So that's all I have.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Morrow. Jessica, how do we incorporate, how do we make an edit so that hours taken for a pediatric endorsement count towards the general requirement of the permit?
So I think that could be a pretty easy fix. It just kind of depends on where we want to put it. It can just be a simple line after the requirements for the pediatric endorsement, or it can be in the continuing education section. It just kind of depends on where you want to put it.
My initial thought is to put it in after the pediatric endorsement. Dr. Caputo?
Jessica, just go to where it's initially written in that third section of that to obtain the go down to the third part of D. I think, and then this is something that doesn't have to obviously be done now, but for example, if you look at the continuing education requirements, it says 30, no, it doesn't say it there.
20 credit hours.
Well, in one section it said in a, Oh, this is for the 1301. I know in the 1303, it says in addition to. I just think that anything that indicates that it's more than what is being asked. And so I think you're going to have to do this in every area. And maybe this is something to use a term you used earlier, Anthony, pin this to go back and make it so that it basically says whatever the hours that the board wants for each of these permit levels can be accomplished through the total number of renewal hours. That the challenge in the rules is in many of the sections, it says to obtain or renew. And that's where I think sometimes the language gets confusing.
Thank you. Dr. Caputo.
You're going to have to do this for every area, Anthony. So you may want to just jump on it later.
What are your thoughts on that, Jessica?
Yeah, that's fine. What I'm thinking is I'll put this here for now. And then obviously with all of the changes that we're making, you know, the committee and the board, they're going to have to go through all of these additional changes one more time before it can make it to GRC or before it even has a supplemental notice of proposed rulemaking that's submitted with the Secretary of State, prompting a second oral comment period. So I'm going to type, this is by no means what I would suggest. This is just off the top of my head, and I don't love it, but it gets the point across.
Okay. Do we need to vote on this?
I will defer to Seamus.
Seamus?
Yes, please, everything.
I make a motion that we make the modification so that the CE hours taken for the pediatric endorsement can count towards the general requirement of the permit holder.
Morrow seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. Motion carries, none opposed.
Excuse me, if this is an okay time, this is Kristen, the court reporter. Can you guys hear me?
We can.
Okay. I don't know if you guys were made aware, if anyone was, but I have a replacement coming in, or if she's already in, maybe. I thought since there was a pause there and you just voted, if she's here, it might be a good time for her to take over. I didn't see her come on, but she texted me that she was coming on.
I'm not in.
Okay, okay.
Great, thank you.
All right, there you go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So I believe that brings us to D2A. And the comment was, since subsection A specifies that the applicant for pediatric endorsement must be within 2 years of completing residency, then subsection B needs to say if the dentist completed residency. Oh, okay. So this is the same comment that we have here. And I agreed with the comment, but that's obviously for you as the board to decide.
I did too. I mean, Dr. Arnell, you can speak to this, but for the sake of moving things along, basically we get in this 1 year time frame where people may not meet the requirements for the first or the second. So you're trying to bridge that gap from what I understand.
Yeah, it's just a simple fix.
you know, on one end, it's less than two, and on the other end, it's greater than two, not greater than three. Otherwise, you have less than two, and then a year gap, and then greater than three. So really easy, less than two or greater than two.
So I'll make a motion that we accept this comment, accept this edit.
Morrow seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
All right, that brings us to a comment on moderate sedation. Snell comments that shouldn't the term moderate sedation be removed from this paragraph, as this is limited to a 1301 provider, and we want these providers to provide an affidavit stating that they've utilized deep sedation or general anesthesia to 30 pediatric patients. It doesn't make sense to include moderate sedation cases for these 30 patients for a 1301 pediatric endorsement.
I guess I'd want to hear from our 1301 permit holders on this. I mean, if you're doing a moderate sedation on a pediatric patient, should that count towards the 30 case requirement?
I would have to say it should. It's considered an anesthetic. So my vote would be it would count towards that. And I not only say that in terms of the statute and the rule and keeping the pediatric endorsement, but also from the point of view of practice. Many of these cases, you might put someone in a deep sedation to get the local anesthetic administered, and then the rest of the case is moderate sedation. So I think that's a light light definition, slippery slopes per se, that I would just leave it in. I think that it's worked for years, and I don't think changing it does any good.
Jessica.
So I guess my question would be, there's nothing in here that would prevent someone from having all of their pediatric cases be moderate sedation.
Correct. Dr. Lau. Dr. Lau?
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to turn my thing on. That was the intent of putting this in the first, initially, so people get their required cases for pediatric endorsement.
Yeah, I mean, I think we leave this alone as well. Dr. Fukami?
So I actually would be I would remove the moderate sedation. So my number one, and I need to take a look at this, but my understanding is that any 1301 permit holder is able to provide moderate sedation for any age group, pediatric or otherwise.
Correct.
Right. Yes, that's correct.
Right. So strictly in order to obtain a pediatric endorsement for general anesthesia, that's the whole point of having the pediatric endorsement in the first place for GA. So there, it wouldn't be necessary, number one, to have moderate sedation categorized in this subsection anyway. Second, you wouldn't need moderate sedation cases in pediatric to continue to provide moderate sedation for pediatrics if you have a GA permit, right? And then number three, I think Dr. Blazek, what you just described, where you do provide deep sedation at any point during your anesthetic, even though the later points may return to moderate sedation level, would actually be classified as a deep sedation for the duration of that anesthetic. So that would qualify as one of your deep sedation cases. So in the end, really what is most consistent and most consistently applied and preserves the intent of the pediatric endorsement would be to remove this moderate sedation section and just leave it as deep sedation or general anesthesia for 30 pediatric patients.
Dr. Arnell.
I agree completely with Dr. Fukami. I feel that this is a pediatric endorsement to provide general anesthesia or deep sedation. And honestly, I don't see a large set of pediatric patients being moderately sedated anyway. And we wouldn't want someone to have a pediatric endorsement who couldn't show that they had for a 1301, pediatric endorsement for a 1301, who couldn't show that they had done general anesthesia on these pediatric patients. So I think we should remove moderate sedation.
Dr. Caputo.
Well, I mean, for the sake of the conversation that preceded this about safety and the concern about having some level of competency, you may want to look at the following line then, because it basically this section says that a dentist who wants a pediatric endorsement at a 1301 permit level doesn't have to do any of these cases. As they say, cases completed with a practitioner who maintains a section 1301 permit with the pediatric endorsement can count towards the 30 cases. So they can do zero. I know there was a loud cry earlier about having at least some minimum competency, even though we couldn't really put a number on that. This particular section allows for zero. Thank you.
Dr. Arnell, your hand's still up. I'm indifferent. I can't imagine there's a lot of practitioners out there that are going to get 30 pediatric IV moderate sedation patients to try to accomplish this. So if you guys feel like it should be out, if that's the consensus, then I'll make a motion that we accept Dr. Snell's comments and remove moderate sedation.
This is Christensen. I think you have a motion on the table. Is that right?
Yeah, just second it, and then we go to discussion.
Christensen seconds.
Go ahead, Eddie.
Yeah, this is Christensen. I think the Dr. Caputo, what he was stating is, I think it was allowing the intent of what was in that measure for surgeons that were providing pediatric care in facilities like Phoenix Children's or Cardinals Children's Hospital. If they're participating in these pediatric cases, that they could count. They were there assisting with the innovation and anesthetic of the patient with the anesthesiologist. If they were close to being able to maintain that pediatric endorsement, I think that was some of the intent of that. So just to comment on that. So the moderate sedation, I can see his point on that. Was brought up earlier.
I'm going to call this to vote. We're in discussion right now. So all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed. Go ahead, Jessica.
One second before Jessica goes, if I leave, are we still going to have a quorum? Because I have a board of directors meeting for 8X.
So we're going to lose another member at 5:30. So I think we're at 7 with you. Without you, we'd have the minimum quorum of 6. And then the other member at 5:30, we would be at 5 with no quorum.
I don't know how long this meeting goes for.
Midnight, I think.
What was that?
Midnight, I think. We're progressing.
Oh, my
let me look real quick and see what the count is. Actually, versus me trying to count, Dr. Hero, do you want to just do a roll call to see how many members we have to see how this is going to affect the quorum?
Yeah, and Beanstalk was talking about logging on too. So we might pick her up, but I'm here, Dr. Christensen.
Yes, I'm here.
Mr. Diner.
Yeah, I'll be here till 7.
Mr. Goodman.
Yeah, Goodman's the one that's supposed to leave at 5:30.
Dr. Seaman.
Here. I have Ms. to leave Pena? At 7.
I'm here till the end.
Oh, sorry, Jasmine. I forgot about you. Ms. Pena.
Thanks, Dr.
I'm here until 5:30.
Okay. So we may lose our quorum at 5:30, Ryan.
And you'll lose it either way, even if I stayed. But
okay.
All right, I got to run.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Morrow.
Thank you. All right,
so what I'm going to do is I'm not calling on anybody other than board members unless we really have a need, so we can just try to move things along.
Okay, that brings us to subsection H. Section 1301 permit holder shall keep anesthesia or deep station record for each patient. Comment on number 4, documentation of intraoperative and postoperative monitoring of ventilatory status. Comment was, how is ventilation monitoring with PS should be pre-tracheal documented? Could have further comments. There is substantial support for a documented action plan where the licensee would define their practice and approach.
You can bypass this, Anthony.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
So because it was a comment, we do need a board response.
Then I'll make a motion that we reject it.
Okay.
Good second. Seconds the rejection.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. And
so, motion passes and opposed. We can just say that the commenter, Dr. Buddha, can we just say that you rescinded this?
What I'd like you to do, since you have a committee that's been assigned to make some interpretations of these rules, is just allow that particular comment to be addressed in that committee, because that's how it'll happen.
Well, good thing you're on that committee.
Yep.
Because it's being recorded by a court reporter, I didn't catch the second. I'm not sure she did either.
There were two, but I definitely heard Dr. Christensen.
And just for the record, the comment is being held for a more appropriate committee.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, that brings us to subsection N. Caputo recommends that the board consider the following insertion after services. Which I am looking for. Oh, here we go. Okay. Accepting full responsibility for the conduct of the procedure, including review of medical records, health status clarification, plan for sedation or anesthesia technique, and preparation for any emergency response.
Anthony, wasn't there also a comment to put this in 1304?
Yes. It just makes it consistent in both areas.
Jessica?
Permit holder?
No.
Is it the permit holder who's accepting full responsibility for the conduct of the procedure, including review of medical records, health status classification, plan for sedation? Is that, or is that what the QAP is doing?
No, because it says the permit holder. So it is the permit holder.
Okay.
And then in 1304, it would be the dentist. to your point, Jessica, but it just makes the language consistent in both sections.
And I will say I like this comment based upon a lot of adverse occurrences that we've adjudicated during board meetings. I think this is appropriate. So I would make a motion that we accept it.
Seamans. Seconds.
Jessica, go ahead.
So I'm obviously I have no horse in this race, right? But my concern is, as the treating dentist, aren't they already doing this by the nature of being the treating dentist? And furthermore, because they're using a QAP, accepting full responsibility for the conduct of the procedure makes me a little bit nervous, because yes, they're the treating dentist. They have certain requirements and a standard that they have and a duty to their patient, but a QAP is also going to have a duty to the patient. And I don't want anything to make someone think that the QAP has less responsibility to the patient simply because the treating dentist now is taking full responsibility for the conduct of the procedure.
What if you eliminated full?
I think I would still have the same question or concern. And I guess my bigger question is, why is this necessary? Isn't this already something that the dentist is taking on by virtue of treating the patient?
Many would argue that they are not, that they are completely deferring all that responsibility.
To the QAP.
To the QAP.
I see.
Mr. Begay, I apologize. I'm not going to take hands right now unless there's a board member has a direct question for a non-board member.
So this is Jessica. I would say I get where you guys are going with this, and I would be happy to put language in there. I just don't know if this specific language does what you want it to do without creating additional issues.
So is this something you can work on for us?
Yes, I would recommend that you approve including the concept.
Then I'll amend my motion that we approve the concept. And Dr. Christensen, will you amend your second?
Yes, I'll amend my second. Christensen.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
Diner opposed.
Motion carries, one opposed.
Okay. The next comment that we have is Snell comments that did not see paragraph like this in 1302 or 1303 sections of the document, feel that it should be included in the other two sections if it's included in 1301, since 1302 and 1303 providers are also able to work with a QAP. Recommend it be section Q in 1302 and section R in 1303.
So I'll make a motion. I mean, Jessica, maybe this can be kind of along the lines of the last one, that in concept, you know, I agree, the board would agree, and you can just go through and make sure that the other permits are consistent with this language. And that's my motion, if I can get a second.
Christensen seconds.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries, none opposed.
Okay, that brings us down to subsection P. Looks like Kami had recommendation 1301 permit holder who administers general anesthesia or deep sedation shall ensure that the following additional persons are present in addition to the permit holder with the patient during the procedure. One person with current certification in ACLS or PALS or completion of 4 clock hours of board approved course in advanced airway management, emergencies management, or general anesthesia, and then and one person with current certification in BLS healthcare provider level.
Dr. Arnell, was this the same? Didn't you have a comment on this one as well? And I think Dr. Caputo, I think there were multiple comments on this one, right?
Yes, I did. And actually, this is one of the sections that when it went, you know, if you look at the document that went to the AZSOS, section P and R were different and much better. And I would suggest to the board that they take Dr. Fukami's language for both P and R. She wrote it beautifully, and it's actually it's exactly what went to the AZSOS, and it's the way it should be. So both P and R really do need to be edited to be in line with Cynthia Fukami's comments, and it makes both of these sections just perfect.
Great. I'll make a motion that we accept Dr. Fukami's comments on P and R. We have a motion on the table. Can we get a second?
Moffitt, or Karma seconds. Sorry.
Now I don't feel so bad, Carmo.
I know.
All right, go ahead, Jessica.
So I just want to make sure that I'm understanding, because when I read Dr. Arnell's comment, which I think is the same as Dr. Fukami's, it's changing who is required to be present. Because this is for any Section 1301 permit holder, right? This is not just for someone who has a pediatric endorsement. That is actually addressed later in R. And so when I read these comments, my response was that the section's ensuring that a 1301 permit holder has one other person present during general anesthesia, which must be a PALS person if the patient is less than 8 years old. If it's not a patient who's less than 8 years old, then they can have one person who is either ACLS or recognized continuing education.
Dr. Fukami, would you clarify for us?
Yes. So the intent is never to change what training the initial or primary permit holder has. You know, anyone who's treating, who's the primary permit holder who's treating kids and has a pediatric endorsement should have PALS. Anyone who treats older patients should have ACLS. This is a question as to what does the second person carry? And you have to look to what is the intention for that second person that's in the room. I would argue that while it would be nice to have the concurrent, whether it's ACLS or PALS, depend on the age group, that I don't think that's as absolutely necessary to do so. I think what is important is to have one of them, but that person is going to acquire the skill set that's needed to assist the person that has all of those trainings in place, that at least at the basic principle that would exist with either of them. And my concern is that by putting it in regulatory measure, that the second person has to have PALS, for example, if they see kids, then let's take some examples. If you have a pediatric dentist that you're working with that has PALS, and that, for example, in my situation, for example, and they have a 10-year-old child, are we going to require that the pediatric dentist has ACLS so that they can serve as a second person? Or if you're working with an oral surgeon who has ACLS because they see a lot of older patients, and then on that day they bring you in specifically in order to treat an 8-year-old, are we going to require that they have PALS? Whereas in those situations, I think, of course, I will have all of those, but would it not be, I think, more than sufficient for that second person who does a lot of anesthesia sedation in their particular categories, is ready to assist, and has the necessary skill set that is provided by having any of these listed. And so I think to simplify in order to unify it, because right now as written, it's very inconsistent. I think it should be this way for both sections P and R.
Thank you, Dr. Jessica.
Really, the question before you is, if you're a 1301 permit holder and you're treating someone who's less than 8 years of age, should the second person that you have in the room with you have only PALS, or is it okay if they only have ACLS?
Are you asking me to comment, or is that what you're presenting to the board? Because my answer is yes.
That's what I'm presenting to the board. The board needs to decide if that second person who's with the 1301 permit holder who is treating someone who is less than 8 years old, needs that second person to absolutely have PALS, or if it's okay that the only person who has PALS is the 1301 permit holder.
And may I point out as well that this is an issue that has already been addressed in the previous iterations. It was actually written like this. It just seems to be changing all the time. And I believe in 1302 and in 1303, it actually might be written as such as well. So whatever decision is made on this particular section seems to be applicable to the other ones too. That's a concern. So, you know, I think take that into account. I will tell you that the language that I put here has been presented or at least included in previous iterations and especially for other sections too. And it should be applicable to all.
So I think what Dr. Fukami is proposing here is what was intended. I'm comfortable with the motion that I made in support of accepting her edits. And, well, let's get a roll call, Sherry, on this one, and then I'll say one more comment.
Hero?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Dinar?
Yes.
Goodman?
Yes.
Carmo?
Yes.
Penna?
Yes.
Penna?
Yes.
And Seaman?
Yes.
Motion passes, none opposed. I'd make a second motion that, Jessica, you make sure this language is consistent, the new language that is in support of Dr. Fukami's edits, that language is consistent in the other sections. And that's a motion. If I can get a second. Thank you, Dr. Christensen. Discussion. So, and I guess to clarify, Dr. Fukami, this motion should address your second concern, and which I know is not just your concern, but I know Dr. Arnell spoke to and Dr. Caputo spoke to it. We want to duplicate this language throughout all the permits, including the 1304 language, correct?
Yes.
That's correct. Dr. Arnell, that's correct.
Yes. The way that Cynthia wrote this covers perfectly for 1301, 1304, and any other section.
Great. Jessica, do you need me to clarify that motion?
No, I think I got it. Okay. So we want that second person to be able to have PALS or ACLS. It should be consistent in 1302 and 1303. And then when we get to R.
Yeah, PALS, ACLS, or the
continuing education.
Or the continuing education. And that should also be in 1304.
Okay.
And Anthony, the reference to section R needs to be added. It was one of my comments for 1304. 1304 addresses P, but it doesn't address R. We just need to add that reference in 1304 to section 1301R.
All right. Well, we've got a motion and a second on the table. All in favor?
Oh. Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes, none opposed.
Anthony, can I just interject one quick comment?
Sure.
Really quickly, and I know you can see the comments, the section written out in the comment section. I put in parentheses moderate sedation where applicable versus general anesthesia deep sedation because it probably should be one or the other depending on which permit type you're talking about. But I think for 1304, it needs to be probably the higher standard, right? So it would be the general anesthesia, right? Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you, doctor. Okay, Jessica, back to you. You can move us along.
Okay. Okay, sorry. Give me 1 second. I'm cleaning stuff up as we go. Okay. So was there a board response for, looks like Dr. Fukami's additional comment related to this P section. Careful monitoring is an important safety aspect of any anesthetic. The primary responsibility of monitoring the patient should be the trained licensee, section 1301 permit holder, and not relegated to an unlicensed person. This phrasing must be included, then it could instead read as the section 1301 permit holder shall ensure the additional person present according to subsection P assists in monitoring the patient during the procedure. So does the board have a specific response to this, or has this already been addressed with using this language here?
Matt, you want to comment to that? You got your hand up.
I'm sorry, my hand was up on accident.
Cynthia, are you comfortable with the last motion we made? Does that address this concern that you brought up, or is this separate?
No, it's actually a separate concern, and I'm actually badly trying to find the section, but I think it was pertaining to it makes me hesitate to see language in the regulatory measure that says something about it being the primary responsibility of an unlicensed person to monitor this patient. I mean, I think that's really language that needs to be included here, and that's not something that I think I recognize where that came from, but
it's section Q.
Yeah, can we?
Section Q is what you're referring to.
I don't know that I would want to think it'd be appropriate for their language to say that the primary responsibility should be an unlicensed person for monitoring the patient that's under anesthesia.
Well, so I would ask Drs. Blazek or Christensen to comment, but I think that this is perhaps an important rule for the team model OMFS uses. I'm going off recollection that's why this is here, and I could be wrong. But Dr. Christensen or Dr. Blazek, could you comment to that? Or Dr. Arnell?
Yes, in the team model, this is Christensen.
I mean, yeah. That's, go ahead, Eddie.
Teams that are trained and will assist in monitoring the patient during an anesthetic, that's why the language is as such.
Dr. Blazek, is that consistent with what you were going to say?
Yeah.
Great.
Well,
I'm going to make a motion that
Dr. Hero, I just real quick, it's twofold. I would agree with Dr. Christensen said. But I think there's a secondary aspect that the intent of the committee, which has been, I think, the intent in the statutes for at least 10 years, is that once the patient's recovered from the anesthetic, then that monitoring of the patient can be relegated to a third level provider. Much like we do in the operating room, that the patient leaves the OR when they're under the oversight of the MDA, CRNA, and then they transfer to the post-op area, and then the nurse oversees the patient monitoring. So I think it's kind of the same idea that we're the intent of the language. Would be my point.
Then I'm going to make a motion, and we'll see where it goes, that we reject the second comment from Dr. Fukami.
Christensen seconds.
Discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes, none opposed. I do want to say, and Jessica, I'll turn it over back to you in a second. I want everyone to know how much I appreciate you guys being here. I mean, not just the board members, but particularly the non-board members. I don't mean to be cutting anybody off. Just for the sake of time and efficiency, I am trying to move this along. But go ahead, Jessica.
So I just wanted to make sure. So if we read that subsection Q, you know, in conjunction with what the new P is going to be, then you're saying that the operating dentist, who is the 1301 permit holder, can ensure or must ensure that the additional person present under subsection P could be for a pediatric patient, someone who does not have PALS. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
Okay.
Because the primary, the treating, the 1301 permit holder would have PALS. It's the secondary person.
I guess that's where I'm getting confused, because Q is saying that the additional person has the responsibility of monitoring the patient during the procedure, but that additional person in the case of a child under P1 may not have PALS. And as long as that's okay, I just want to make sure that that's clear.
Yeah, because the intent of this, and again, Eddie or Randy could speak to it, but it's not saying that the person who's primarily monitoring the patient is the unlicensed person, is the second person. The operator anesthetist, the oral surgeon, would be the primary one monitoring them. It's just that the second person's responsibility would be to only monitor and not do anything else. And I don't know if I'm explaining that well, but I believe that's the intent of the team model. Eddie, is that?
That is correct. That is correct. Thank you, Dr. Hero.
If I may, I think Cynthia's comment was misunderstood. She wasn't trying to get rid of Section Q. All she was saying was that that has the primary responsibility of assisting and monitoring the patient during the procedure. That's all she was saying. She wanted to keep that section, but she wanted to say that that secondary person assists the primary person. She was just going to add one word, responsibility of assisting and monitoring the patient during the procedure.
But you're conferring legal responsibility onto the person that's monitoring if you put it in here, right? At least that's going to be implied by saying that they have the primary responsibility. The person with the primary responsibility is the licensee or the permitted person.
Right. I think we're all saying the same thing. You just are trying to clarify the intent is what it sounds like, Cynthia.
I think with this phrasing, it would have helped that, but it doesn't affect me personally, but right. I thought that it would help with those others on who utilize this model to make it clear for them and to protect their staff.
Jessica.
So thank you guys for discussing this. And I know it can be tedious parsing words, but, I think that discussion just now has helped me better understand what you guys are trying to say, because I think I was reading this, considering we're the ones who wrote it, I found it confusing as well, because I completely agree. It's the licensee, right? It's the 1301 permit holder who has the responsibility of monitoring their patient. If you put primary responsibility, it makes it sound like now the responsibility for monitoring the patient is first on the additional person, when it's really not. Really, the person who has the first responsibility of monitoring the patient is in fact the treating dentist, is what I'm hearing from everybody. And then,
Absolutely. Then
what we're really trying to say is that the number one responsibility of the additional person, so they may have three responsibilities, but their number one responsibility should be in monitoring the patient. That's in addition to the dentist, treating dentist themselves having the responsibility of monitoring the patient first and foremost. Is that accurate?
Yes, and I think that would, I don't want to speak for our oral surgeons, but I think that's accurate.
Yes, and maybe that's the best in addition to. I mean, you said that, Jessica.
So okay. Why don't I rescind? I mean, then I'll make a motion to rescind my previous motion or the previous vote. How do you want to handle that, Seamus?
It's really up to you. There's no template. If you want to, you know, rescind anything, get rid of it, add it back in, it's all up to you guys. As long as you can catalog it all and staff can get it down.
You can just make your own motion.
Yeah, I'll just make a new motion that, Jessica, we just confer the responsibility to you to wordsmith this to capture the intent, and we can review it at the next meeting.
Got it.
Eddie, you want a second?
Christian's in seconds.
So just to clarify, that's a delegation to Jessica to capture the language that you've just discussed and bring it back to the board later?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
Okay. And so now we have another comment here also on P by Dr. Caputo, but I think we may have resolved that with the previous board motions. Is that correct?
Anthony?
Yes.
That your next comment can go away based on what we just voted on.
Nothing I provided should go away, Anthony, but I understand.
Yeah, I think we can move on, Jessica.
Okay. That brings us to also in subsection P, 1301. FACAMI recommends the section 1301 permit holder who obtains a pediatric endorsement according to subsection D and who administers general anesthesia or deep sedation to a patient who is less than 8 years of age shall ensure the following additional persons are present. Oh, okay. I think this was probably meant to go under R. Sorry. We're down here in R.
You're in R. You meant R.
Okay. Okay, so again, this is, I think, the difference between should it just be a PALS or should it be a PALS or an ACLS?
So I would,
if I'm not mistaken, we already voted on P and, or I'm sorry, not we, I'm not on the board.
We did. I think we took P and R together, Jessica.
Okay. And so that's where instead of just PALS, it should be PALS or ACLS, right?
Yes, and also she addressed R2, which she fixed there as well. Her whole comment was beautiful, perfect.
Okay, anything else in 1301 before we get to 1302?
Dr. Caputo?
Yes, there is. I'm not sure why it didn't get to Jessica, but this was a oral comment that I had provided. Ryan, do you know if you guys have that or not?
Yeah, it's in the packet. You can go ahead and state it, and it'll probably refresh everybody's memory.
All right. So I had during my testimony at the previous meeting made a proposal, and I am looking. I had it pulled up earlier, and now it's not here. Here it is now. I'll just give you the condensed version. We have already addressed in this document, in R411-1301 subsection F4, a similar approach. So just going off of that approach used in that subsection and area, as I identified F4, I proposed a new section V that states a section 1301 permit holder who meets the requirements of subsection E2 and is a diplomat in good standing with the American Board of Dental Anesthesiology is considered in compliance with the continuing education requirements in subsection B6, subsection D2B, and subsection U1. This is not changing anything. It's not a significant change. It just recognizes what you already did, as I mentioned earlier, in F4, with those particular residency-trained anesthesiologists. I gave you some background in that with respect to that. The only thing that might have to be adjusted here is we, I believe, deleted subsection B6, which is in reference to the human simulation, so that might have to be amended. But the presentation is to just recognize dentists who are trained in anesthesiology as specialists and recommend and have board certification that they meet the effectively the continuing education requirements to obtain to maintain the permit. Thank you.
And if I can add on real quick to jog your memories about this, ASDA through Dr. Cobb basically added in the same thing.
Thank you. It was nice to have the Dental Association support on this this proposed change and recommendation.
Dr. Blazek, or Jessica, I didn't see you put
the hand up. So it's a lot to take in there, the reading of that. So I'm just going to kind of paraphrase in my own words, Dr. Caputo. You're basically saying that a dental anesthesiologist does not need to renew because of their advanced training, renew their permit because of their training. Is that what you're requesting?
No. All I'm saying is that by virtue of their maintenance of board certification, they meet the renewal requirements. And so all they would do, Randy, is submit their documentation for their board certification, and then they are recognized as meeting the CE requirements. And so they are renewing. They're just meeting it through their educational pathway that's already in place.
I understand. Okay. I get you. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Jessica, go ahead.
So I think I'm understanding that there is a group of anesthesiologists who get their CEs through a different method. And all we're trying to do is clarify that if they have gotten those CEs through that different method, then they have fulfilled their requirements under these rules for their continuing education. Okay. So.
Yeah. And just so the board knows, and I appreciate that comment, Jessica, the requirements for maintenance of certification at that level is three times what is required by the rules. So it's well in excess of what the rules even currently require. It's certainly not less.
So can Dr. Caputo, can you tell me where in 1301 we have that?
Yeah, and so the sections that were referenced, first of all, they have to meet the requirements of subsection E2 in 1301, and then they would be in compliance with subsection D2B and subsection U1. I mentioned in my proposal subsection B6, but per previous conversation, that section has been removed. That was the human simulation.
Anthony, just a quick question. This is Blazek. And I'm just curious, do you guys have dental anesthesiologists that are not boarded?
Yes.
So then what would be their mechanism?
They'd have to comply with the board. That's why it says they'd have to be in good standing as a diplomat. And if not, they'd have to meet the board requirements as already referenced. So they have a mechanism. They're not removed or avoided.
Dr. Beanstack, are you on? I think Dr. Beanstalk's on. I just want to make sure she can hear us.
So,
hi, this is Dr. Beanstalk. I'm here.
So before we move on, Sherry, let's get a roll call.
Kiro?
Yes.
Beanstalk?
Yes, here. Hi.
Christensen?
Yes.
Dinar?
Present.
Goodman? On. Carmo? Carmo?
Here.
Pena? Pena?
Here. I can stay for one more.
You cut out for how long?
For one more vote.
Okay. And Seaman.
Here.
But so even when Miss Pena leaves, we'll still have a quorum, right? Because we got seven people with Vicky.
Correct.
Great. So Vicky, if you're pressed on time, you don't have to stay on.
Thank you. Everyone be safe. Have a good evening.
You as well. Thanks again.
Thanks, Vicky.
So, Jessica, I mean, I can just make another motion like I have in the past where I'd move that you adopt the language that's being discussed here with Dr. Caputo, and then we can review it at a future meeting.
Sure. And Dr. Caputo, if you could send that language, I'm not sure where it ended up or from the oral comments, but if you could send that language to Ryan or one of the staff, and then they can get it to me so that I can actually wordsmith it into the rules, that'd be great.
They have it.
Okay.
Thank you.
And there's a motion on the table if I can get a second.
I have seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, not opposed.
Okay. Anything else in 1301 before we move on to 1302? Okay. Moving on to 1302. Dr. Caputo recommends amending A2 to read a section 1302 permit holder shall not administer or employ any agents, drugs, or techniques or any combination thereof, which have a narrow margin for maintaining consciousness that would likely render a patient deeply sedated, generally anesthetized, or not meeting the conditions of moderate sedation. A general statement is better than any indication of specific drug classes or categories, particularly for the purposes of investigation and adjudication.
Anthony, were you part of the committee that wrote this language originally?
I don't know if it was done at the last committee or not. I actually would defer to Heath if he's on. If he has, he was on obviously the committee too. I don't like to name names. I just think it's tough to have that in rule, but, it's really not a fight that is major to me. It just, again, I think this language being more general still meets the same point, but I'm completely open.
Matt.
Dr. Ryan. I would support Anthony's comment here. I mean, I can think of one right off the top of my head that isn't on the list. And that's remifentanil. That, you know, remifentanil should only be used in the context of general anesthesia. It's not on the list. And as time goes on, there's going to be all sorts of drugs that come along that should only be used in the context of general anesthesia. So I do support what Anthony Caputo wrote here. It's better to make it a definition that covers the future as opposed to a list of the drugs currently that would fall under that definition.
Great. Then I'll make a motion that we adopt the edit that Dr. Caputo's recommended.
Christensen seconds.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes, none opposed.
Couldn't stay away. Dr. Hero, you got another board member who joined.
Yeah, Mauro just came back in.
Oh, great. Welcome back.
I do my best to be everywhere.
Okay. So I believe that the changes that I just made reflect the comment. I'm getting nods from Dr. Caputo, so I'm assuming we're good. Awesome. Okay. We are on number two, forms provided by the board, provided dated and signed affidavit attesting that any dental office or dental clinic where the dentist will administer moderate sedation.
He's already shot this one down earlier, so it's the same. So you can just say it was previously denied or withdrawn by the board, whatever language.
When you make 100 suggestions, Anthony, some are bound not to make it through.
And yes, I do realize that I'm not even going to try. Benzodiazepine?
Peen.
Peen? I was close. And antiarrhythmic?
That's just spelling that Dr. Arnell had already pointed out.
Yeah, so when I go through and fix the spelling in the other sections, I'll make sure it gets fixed throughout.
You're just not putting paralytic in this section. And it's not there, but just so you know, I just didn't want you to think. That's the only thing that'll be different here is that you won't have the non-depolarized or the neuromuscular blocker.
Yep, got it.
Matt, did you mean to have your hand up or is that left over?
I'm sorry. I don't know why I keep doing that. It's terrible.
After a few years now, I just can kind of sense when you've accidentally left it up.
This is no longer valid, so we're removing that section.
Yep.
Let me double check something before we get too far. Okay, that brings us to D3. Snell comments, this paragraph mentions that cases for enteral moderate sedation completed with a dental practitioner who maintains pediatric endorsement counts towards the 15 cases. Opinion would be that the Section 1301 permit be replaced with Section 1302 permit. So I'm assuming that we're talking about this right here with a dental practitioner who maintains a 1301 permit because now we're in a 1302 permit. And so it doesn't need to be with a 1301 permit practitioner. It could be with a 1302 permit practitioner.
Yeah. Is Heath here?
There he is. Heath, go ahead.
Yeah. So I just think what Jessica just said, I don't know that further comment needs to be made. It's 1302 section. I think it should be a 1302 provider stated there.
My only question is, I mean, a 1302, shouldn't it be 1301 or 1302? So if the 1302 permit holder is working with a 1301 permit holder, those cases would count?
I have no problem with that. That's fine. I just don't want to limit them if they're doing intended to do modernization. Again, I think it was stated before, this probably isn't going to come around a lot with kids and modernization, but if it does, I think it should be appropriate that they can be with another 1302 provider. If you want to keep the 1301 in and add it, I have no problem with that.
Okay. Did you get that, Jessica?
Got it. Just need a motion.
So moved.
Mara seconds.
Discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
Oh, okay. And then we needed E. 2B. Snell recommends adding the word moderate after the word parenteral.
I make a motion that we accept Dr. Snell's comment.
Is this the only place that it should be?
No, I think there's a couple of them like this, Jessica.
In this particular section, because we did have...
Well, like right below it.
Yeah, exactly. So we've got it here. And then we've got it here. So maybe we just missed it in that one spot.
Well, the following sentence, too. You probably want to make sure that it's that way.
And is there ever going to be a case where it should not be parenteral moderate?
Not for this permit level.
Okay, so it looks like we need it here and here at the very least. Maybe some other places, but I'll make sure to point them out when I make the changes. Okay. Brings us to H. Dr. Caputo comments. Realistically, this section negates the requirement for any on-site evaluation for renewal, as the requirements could all be verified by affidavit. Effectively, consider changing section G to an affidavit process.
Do you want to speak to that, Anthony?
You're not requiring them to have an on-site evaluation for renewal. Now, maybe G is saying, regardless of H, you're going to have an on-site evaluation at least every 6 years. It seems confusing to me. So just from a consistency standpoint, if you feel as a board that the G and H read fine, then I'm okay with whatever you do. They seem to be conflicting. And it seemed to me that if you're not requiring an on-site evaluation for renewal, then why not just have them do everything by affidavit through their application submission as they already do?
Ryan, do you want to comment to that as board staff?
I'm sorry. I am responding to people that are inquiring about the public comment period, so I wasn't even paying attention.
Anthony, do you want to reiterate it for Ryan?
We're looking at section H in this 1302 renewal, and basically it says that when they do their renewal, they don't have to have an on-site evaluation. Well, G says they have to have an on-site evaluation at least every 6 years. That seemed conflicting to me, and I was just making the comment that if their on-site evaluation is not required, then they could submit by affidavit and be fine. So it seemed to be a conflicting rule based on the G and H together.
Specific to F2B, I don't think it's saying that when you renew, you don't need an on-site inspection. F2B is specific to you don't need to sedate a patient.
Right. So all you'd be doing is just the review of the scenarios. I'm not a big scenario person myself, but anyways, that's just what I was looking at.
Jessica?
I vaguely recall this conversation, and correct me if I'm wrong, what we were trying to get at was, if you're doing an initial, then you have to do the on-site evaluation and you have to have the F2B. When it comes to renewal, you need to have an on-site evaluation every 6 years in order to renew, but you don't have to have F2B in order to renew it.
Correct. I think the language fits that, right?
I don't mind retracting it, or you can deny it. It's no big deal.
Can you just put that Dr. Caputo retracts this comment?
Okay, brings us down to K. And number two, Snell comments would add the word parenteral before the word moderate so as to identify that the applicant must be doing parenteral moderate sedation to be able to keep a parenteral moderate sedation permit. Don't think it is appropriate with the changes to the 1303 permit being explicitly enteral moderate sedation to have 1302 providers utilizing enteral moderate sedation to count towards their 10 cases per year in order to renew their 1302 permit. In committee, it was very explicitly stated that the parenteral is very different from enteral, and I believe we want to make sure that our 1302 providers are adept at actually doing parenteral sedation, and this is shown by doing at least 10 cases of parenteral moderate sedation each calendar year. Board response.
I think that's fine. I'll make a motion that we accept Dr. Stahl's comments. Can I get a second?
Christensen's in seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
Okay. Moving on to subsection L. Caputo comments, the implication is that any level or type of sedation administered requires a functional intravenous catheter and recommends that it read, the section 1302 permit holder shall establish a functional intravenous catheter for each patient receiving intravenous sedation.
That makes sense, Anthony.
Yeah, I'm just rereading it. The section shall
establish. If you did an IM sedation, it's basically saying you need a functional intravenous catheter, obviously. So if you put intravenous in before sedation, receiving intravenous sedation services, it still meets the intent and really doesn't change anything.
I make a motion that we accept Dr. Caputo's comment.
Christensen seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed. Dr. Fukami.
It's a little late. I know. I think if in order to provide intravenous sedation, you would have to have an intravenous catheter, right? So maybe Anthony, perhaps what you meant was the establish a functional intravenous catheter for any patient receiving parenteral sedation, maybe?
Well, no, right. Because again, the point is they want a functional intravenous catheter. I get my point. To answer your question, no.
Yeah.
I don't want to belabor the point only because they already voted on it. So you're calling.
I know. All right. I just wanted a clarification. It's probably not worth prolonging, but I think it'll happen.
Okay. brings us to Q. I think this is the same comment that we had before.
Yep.
And yep. Here we actually did have PALS or ACLS, which is different than what we had for 1301. 1301 was just PALS, now we're changing it to ACLS. This one already has it. Is that accurate?
Right. You're doing the OR, yes.
And so Dr. Fakami, correct me if I'm wrong. Does anything actually need to change in this section, or your comment was mostly that this appears to have it the right way and 1301 should have had it like this too?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
And I although this, it doesn't actually have the option of the 4-hour CE, but that's up to the board to decide.
Yeah,
but yes, at least this one had options.
Heath, I'd like to get your opinion, but I think A should read a current certification in PALS, ACLS, or the anesthesia CE or airway CE.
Thank you, Dr. Hero. I would agree completely with that, especially if that's the way it's written in 1301.
Yep.
And I believe that when you guys made the motion for 1301, I think you included making consistent changes to 1302 and 1303.
And 04.
And 04.
And 04. So I don't know that you need another motion. I'll just make sure that those all align.
Great. I motioned out, Jessica.
I'll see what I can do to relieve you.
I appreciate it.
All right. We don't need to discuss American Heart Association because we've already discussed it. That brings us anything else on 1302 before we move on to 1303. Okay. First comment on 1303, Snell and Caputo comment. It currently states a section 1301 permit holder or section 1302 permit holder may also administer oral sedation. Change the term oral sedation to the more proper enteral moderate sedation.
I make a motion that we accept this edit.
Christian, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
Okay. Moving on to subsection B. And here we had a comment. Snell recommends removing the words in addition to the requirements of subsection B2 and 3. But it looks like we're already doing that.
Yeah, I must have had an old version that was sent to me. You can
okay.
Retract that.
Okay. Give me one second. Okay, that brings us then to number two. Similar to 1301B2 and 1302B2, Caputo comments, consider incorporating language to state the permit holder maintains an action plan. So I think we've already addressed this.
Caputo retracts.
Okay, and then I think there was another comment here about emergency drugs. Snell comments, several of these medications are administered in a parenteral manner, specifically intravenously. Do we really expect 1303 providers who have absolutely no training in starting IVs and administering intravenous medications to carry and deliver medications in an emergency that are meant to be given intravenously. How is this providing any added safety to our patients?
Which drugs, Heath?
Wrong side.
Sorry, say that again, Anthony.
Which drugs?
Which drugs would be administered intravenously?
Yeah.
Most of them would be. Which drugs? I mean, the bronchodilator, maybe not.
Your vasopressor can be intramuscular. Your antagonist can be intramuscular. Your antihistaminic can be intramuscular. Your anticholinergic could be intramuscular. Your anticonvulsant could be intramuscular.
Dr. Laut? Dr. Laut, you might be muted.
I am. Sorry about that. The opioid antagonists and the benzodiazepine antagonists can both be given intranasally as well.
Dr. Laut or Dr. Beanstalk, are you comfortable with that list of medication that's required?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with it. I think we went through that two or three times. I'm comfortable with it.
Good.
Me too.
Dr. Snow, do you want to retract that or do you want us to vote on it?
Whatever you'd like me to do, Dr. Hero.
I'd love it if you would retract it.
Let's retract it.
Thank you.
I kind of like hearing you make motions, but I'll retract. That's okay.
I've gotten pretty good at them.
Okay. That is going to bring us then. There was a comment on number 6, but that's already been determined. Brings us to subsection C. And Snell comments this is merely a typo, I believe, but in the second sentence it mentions 1302 permit, and I believe it should say 1303 permit since this is the 1303 section. So I think right here.
Yeah. Yep. I would make a motion that we accept that edit.
Beanstalk second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. Motion carries, none opposed.
Okay. Then brings us to subsection D3. And Dr. Caputo comments, the language appears inaccurate based on the reference to E1. Additionally, the requirement is greater for this patient group than any other. This is a continuous presentation in the rules that appears to imply children under 8 years old are seemingly more important than older patients. Yes, inaccurate. Sir. Yes.
It's already been addressed.
Okay.
This is Fukami's proposed language and that Matthew also spoke to. So we're all good.
Wait, but what about the CE?
But we talked about this and we said we were going to make this consistent with what we did for the other permit levels.
So Jessica, meaning that any continuing education taken towards acquiring the pediatric endorsement would count towards the general continuing education requirement for the 1303 permit.
This was the one that said in addition to, which could easily be changed, but you were going to make that correction throughout to make them all similar. And I apologize. I was thinking about the additional personnel here when I mentioned Cynthia and Matthew, but I think Matthew spoke to this too. But you had a dialogue about this already, just making it consistent. Not the cases, but the CE. And if you go down to your next page.
And Dr. Beanstalk, just because you weren't here for the beginning of the meeting, I do want to make sure you're okay with that portion of the discussion where what we talked about under the 1301 pediatric endorsement, which would also be applied here, is that any CE taken to acquire the pediatric endorsement could count towards the general CE requirement of the permit holder.
I think that makes sense. Yeah. I think that's fair.
And I think it was the intent of the committee. I think it just got kind of muddied when we went through it.
Thanks for looping me in.
Yeah.
All right, our next comment is, Snell says that this is a typo, that in fact it should be enteral moderate sedation. I believe that is accurate.
It is.
I'll make a motion that we accept Dr. Snell's edit.
Dean Sack seconds.
And just to clarify for my own purposes, if I'm not mistaken, we got rid of oral sedation completely, and we're now using enteral moderate sedation. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Amen.
So then should number one be changed to training in basic enteral moderate?
I think that sounds accurate, Dr. Beanstalk.
Okay, I'll make a motion to change number one to enteral moderate sedation, please.
Morrow seconds anything Lisa says.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries unopposed.
Can I interject something here real quick, Dr. Harrow? Dr. Harrow?
Sure.
We have a bare minimum quorum. We're hanging by the skin of our teeth. I had to throw in a teeth joke. So if any of the six of you decide that you have to exit for any reason, just state so before you exit so that we don't have to keep monitoring it.
Just don't tell us so that we can keep moving forward and not have to reconvene.
Right.
That's a joke, court reporter. You don't have to put that in.
All right.
That brings us to subsection G, relating to on-site evaluation. Sorry, got a little ahead of myself. Where did it go?
I think you can, I'll redact this one as well, because I was working off of an older thing, so it's already been done.
Okay. All right, that brings us down to number two. Snell recommends adding in a section under this section that is taken from 1302 F2B, where it mentions the evaluator watching the potential permit holder administer the enteral moderate sedation during the onsite evaluation. The 1302 and 1303 permits are both intended to do moderate sedation, then don't we want to make sure the provider knows how to appropriately administer the sedation and evaluate their patient? I know the 1303 is simply giving the patient a pill to swallow, but do we want to know that the potential permit holder is prudent in the dosages they provide and the timing of future administrations? Keep in mind, many of these potential permit holders may have never actually administered enteral moderate sedation to a patient, but only learned about it in the required 30 clock hours of recognized continuing dental education as stated in subsection E of this 1303 section. There is no requirement for initial applicants to be involved in any clinical cases prior to them doing the enteral moderate sedation in their office. Board response.
Go ahead, Dr. Lout. I think you're on mute, Dr. Lout.
I think in addition to pill, you want to put pill and liquid. Pill or liquid.
All Dr. Snow.
So this is just saying that before the 1303 was not defined as moderate sedation. So I know, having spoken with a lot of general dentists and worked with a lot of general dentists that had a 1303 permit, they were probably working more in the world of minimal, maybe moderate sedation with their protocol. But now that it's explicit that it is moderate sedation, this is just a question, and I don't care which way the board goes, really. But there's no requirement for an applicant to have administered any medication of any sort to obtain a 1303 permit. It would just is strictly CE. And so do we want to, on that initial site visit, make sure that they understand at least the drug so they're not multiple dosing, you know, within 5-10 minutes of each other, when that's not really the way you want someone to administer enteral moderate sedation? So should we implement on that initial on-site visit, just monitoring, or sorry, evaluating them, see a patient like we do in the 1302, since they're both moderate sedation cases?
Dr. Beanstalk or Dr. Lau, would you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I'll say something. I know this is for is this strictly for adults or for is this for adults and pediatric?
It would be adults and pediatric.
I know pediatric we have requirements with cases, and I think the adults does too. If they've had cases, then they'd give an oral medication.
Dr. Snow.
Dr. Lau is absolutely correct for the pediatric one. This is just, I'm looking at this more of for a general dentist, went to an enteral moderate sedation course. All they need to do is, there's no clinical requirement as far as number of patients go in order to obtain a 1303 permit, except for in the pediatric section. Which I'm not implying that we should add that. I'm not implying we should add a number of cases in to an applicant. I'm just questioning, should we have the examiners watch the initial applicant do a sedation and make sure they know what they do or doing, since theoretically a lot of them are going to be applying for their permit, never having done an actual case.
I think we leave things the way they are, is my opinion. So I'm going to make a motion that we reject this comment.
Morrow seconds that.
Discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
And just to clarify, you're rejecting the comment because you don't believe it's necessary?
Correct.
Okay, then that'll be moving us on to subsection I. Snell comments, if a 1303 provider is doing the same level of sedation as a 1302 provider, then why are the requirements for the sedation records different with regards to needed documentation of BP, pulse, SPOT, et cetera? I would recommend mimicking this section in the 1303 permit with the corresponding section from the 1302 permit. If this isn't done, then I would add to this section and change the verbiage in 1302 section I3 to say documentation of intraoperative and postoperative monitoring of patient's ventilatory status. I feel that this adds the importance of monitoring the patient's ventilation, but doesn't restrict it forever and for always to only capnography or precordial stethoscope when future means of monitoring ventilation might come about and be more appropriate. Not to mention the several cases where moderately sedated patients are talking or crying and neither a capnography monitor nor a precordial stethoscope would be able to be effectively used in such situations. In whatever is decided, I do feel that both the 1303 and 1302 permits should be the same with the specific requirement because the intended level of sedation is the same. Board response.
Go ahead, Heath.
So I obviously wrote these with the thought that I may not be here to explain. So I apologize for the so much being so verbose in those writings. But basically what it says is they're both moderate sedation, 1303, 1302. Shouldn't the requirements be the same for the sedation record? I would propose that we actually keep what's here in the 1303 and remove the need for capnography or precordial stethoscope in the 1302, because I think that's limiting. And as we've discussed in previous times, it's better to have more of a general statement. So if you just want to put monitoring ventilatory status, I think that would be appropriate. But I would make them the same in 1302 and 1303 because it's the same level of sedation. So to me, it just makes sense that they would mimic each other.
Is the primary difference the monitoring of the ventilation, Keith?
That's the only difference that I see, correct.
Dr. Bienstock or Dr. Laut, do you have a comment on what are your thoughts on adding monitoring ventilation on a 1303 record?
Well, you know, I think that I would leave as is just because, you know, the capnography is not real effective on a patient that's moving or crying or moving around. You just can't get a good reading. And we've used pre-tracheal for years and years for what we do. And I don't think we're as deep a sedation as we are with the 1302 or 1303.
I
agree with Dr. Laut.
And we're talking the patient crying, not the dentist, right?
Both.
Got it.
Go ahead, Heath.
I 100% agree that I don't think capnography is appropriate for a moderately sedated patient for the reasons Dr. Laut stated. I do disagree that a 1303 is lighter than a 1302. And if that's the case, then we've misdefined what moderate sedation is because they're both defined as moderate sedation. So the level depth of sedation is exactly the same. But I would agree to strike capnography precordial from the list in the 1302 section because it's not here in the 1303 section.
I agree with Keith as far in regards to the level of moderate sedation.
Anthony.
I think the compromise here was just to say some documentation of ventilatory status. And so that would accomplish pretracheal, end tidal, et cetera. So that does both things.
Dr. Bienstock or Dr. Laut, what's standard right now for a pedodontist monitoring a sedated pediatric patient? Is there anything on the record about ventilatory status?
Well, I think in our guidelines, American Academy of Pediatric Dentists guidelines, it says capnography or pretracheal stethoscope.
So you are using, I mean, even though capnography is not really effective in a moderately sedated patient who's moving or crying.
I think it's written to give that option, but the majority of pediatric dentists I know, because the kids move and they fuss and they cry and it's hard to use capnography on them. The majority of pediatric dentists I know use a pretracheal stethoscope.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to lighten these requirements. I mean, we had a death. It was an adult, but it was an oral sedation patient. It was a 1303 permit. I don't even know if he had a 1303 permit or not, but it was an enterally moderate sedated patient. And the licensee overdosed him and he died. So I think it's appropriate to monitor ventilatory status as long as that's consistent with the pediatric guidelines. I don't think we have to specify capnography, certainly, if that's not appropriate. You know, the pretracheal is fine, but I think that should be in here. And I'm not in favor of taking it out of the 1302.
Dr. Hero, are you in favor of having them both say monitor ventilatory status?
Yeah, definitely.
So it's in there in both, but yeah. It's not explicit in either.
Yeah, I'm okay with that, Heath.
I like that as well.
So then I'll make a motion that in in both 13 that we accept Dr. Snell's comments with regards to amending the language to read monitoring ventilatory status in both 1302 and 1303.
Beanstalk seconds.
And for discussion purposes, the only thing I worry about is just adding more regulation, but I don't disagree with it. It's just, I hate adding more.
I think it's always a question of, are we adding good regulation? Not, you know, when people criticize more regulation versus less regulation, I just don't think it's the appropriate conversation. It's, is there regulation that's being added increasing public safety or not? And if it's not, certainly it shouldn't be added. But if it is, then just because it's more doesn't mean it's something that should be criticized, in my opinion.
Well, I agree, best practices versus, you know, regulation, and that time also is all the people who are using it right now, do they have to go out and buy extra equipment and all the other stuff that's associated if it wasn't there before?
Yeah. Well, that's the nature of this, right? I mean, I remember, you know, for years my dad practiced, there wasn't even pulse oximetry. Yep. Certainly, I don't think it'd be appropriate to say, well, they don't have to utilize pulse oximetry because now that came out. So
that's true. And like I said, just being devil's advocate on this one.
Well, Jessica, let's keep this moving. Otherwise, Dr. Morrow and I will eat up the rest of the time just going back and forth.
Yeah. No, that's all the brain power I had right there. That was it. You need a vote.
We didn't vote on that?
Nope.
Oh, thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries, none opposed. Thanks, Russ.
All right, that brings us to number two. Snell comments the word may doesn't need to be included in rule, so couldn't this entire subsection be removed, both A and B? For what it's worth, I agree.
If you're not... and I mean, that makes sense. Should it say will include, or we just eliminate it?
Well, if it's not a requirement, if it's not a shall, then you don't need to put it in there. You're either going to tell people that they have to put something in there or they're not allowed to put something in there. But if they can put something in there, if they feel like it, then you don't really need that in rule.
So what's standard of care for enteral moderate sedation? Are you doing intraoperative blood pressures every 5 to 10 minutes and pre and post operative ECGs? Or no? Dr. Beanstalk, Dr. Loud, or Dr. Stone?
Not the ECGs, but the pulse ox, of course, and the blood pressure.
Jessica?
My comment would be that if it is a required practice, then, because right now we're just talking about the documentation, right? This is just the record. So if those are things that you're doing because you have to do them for the procedure or for post-op, then you probably want to require those things to be in your record.
So at least you think we would remove 2A and just add B under I?
Sure. Here, I think you
that
could.
Works for me, but Heath has his hand up.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Heath. Sorry. LB, if you look at subsection 1B, it says pre and post blood pressure. So you just put pre, intra, and post blood pressure. I don't know right. Why it's not up there anyways.
Then I'll make a motion that we accept Dr. Snell's suggestion by eliminating 2A and B and adding intraoperative to what number was that, Heath?
It's 1A. B.
1B.
1B. Preoperative, intraoperative, and postoperative blood pressure.
Morrow seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed.
Okay, that brings us to subsection K. Caputo comments, for effectively the lowest level of sedation administered in the office that requires a permit, this requirement is greater than any other permit level for additional personnel. Completely excessive and unnecessary, similar to Caputo's recommendations in 1301P and R. So I believe this has already been addressed, right?
Correct.
And it just needs to match what we already decided.
Correct. And it should be L. I think it just got, it's not K because it doesn't make sense. But regardless, it has been addressed.
Okay. Brings us down to L, section permit holder who obtains pediatric endorsement according to substitute and administered motor sedation. Oh, this is the same, right?
Right, correct.
And I think that was it. So anything else on 1303 before we move on to 1304?
I think we can move forward.
Okay. Snell comments. Feel the way that the current 1304 section is written, it precludes 1302 providers from providing moderate sedation in the offices of dentists who would have a 1304 permit. So before I read this comment, there is no 1304 permit anymore. So I'm not sure that this, is this comment still accurate? Is it still applicable?
Go ahead, Heath.
So I'm just, every reference that's made, I shouldn't say every, many of the references that are made in this 1304 section refer back to the QAP having 1301 requirements. But as a 1302 permit holder, if I'm going to go into another dentist's office and provide solely sedation for that dentist, I don't believe that I should be required, if the intent of what I'm doing is moderate sedation, to have to abide by 1301 guidelines, but all the references in the 1304 section reference the 1301 permit. That's my concern.
No, Dr. Arnell.
So the fundamental challenge here is that every QAP of whatever type that's a permitted dentist already attests to all these things. So Heath, both I and Dr. Caputo separately, we made recommendations that this read, let's see, hang on just a second. Working with a QAP that is not a licensed dentist in Arizona, that would take care of all of that. Because your 1302 allows you to get a mobile permit. It allows you to go to other offices under your rules, under 1302. My permit allows me to get a mobile permit and to go provide my services under my 1301. And all of our attestations are in place. And what happens when all permitted dentist QAPs are looped into 1304 is we get endless circular redundancies because we've already attested to these things. And then to try to make this section apply to everyone who's already attested is, it's an endless battle. But if we just say that each permitted dentist is held accountable to their section, and then the QAPs that are non-permitted dentists, or I'm sorry, not permitted dentists, their section is 1304. And then since those two categories are either CRNAs or physician anesthesiologists, their permit is a 1301, or essentially what they provide is general anesthesia like a 1301, then all those references make sense.
Jessica.
So I'll read you my comment. So my response when I saw the comment about adding in a dentist that's not licensed in Arizona is I understand that it seems duplicative, but really what's going on with 1304 is that you're putting the onus on the treating dentist to ensure that their co-op, even if they're another dentist, has these things. If you remove it and you only make this applicable to a co-op who is not a dentist licensed in Arizona, then what you're essentially doing is absolving the treating dentist from all responsibility and requirements of overseeing their co-op who happens to be another dentist. So well, the dentist who's doing the operation in and of themselves, yes, they are a permit holder. They are the ones who are providing the anesthesia. So they have to comply with all of the rule sections and requirements that allow them to operate as that permit holder. The fact that they are actually working as a co-op doesn't mean that the person who's utilizing them as a co-op doesn't also have similar responsibilities. And so part of the issue is that this isn't telling the co-op what to do. This is telling the overseeing dentist what to do. You can't regulate the co-op. You can only regulate the dentist.
Yes, and you are right. You can't regulate the non-physician. Sorry.
Seamus, go ahead.
Yeah, I apologize. This is AAG Monahan. I didn't want to jump in, and I certainly don't want to, you know, quell any conversation. I just want to make sure that, you know, we're not having any back and forth on this as much as the board does not need the explanation. Because we are just here to, you know, review the comments and receive explanation if necessary. I just want to make sure that we kind of refocus in on that. So thank you.
No, I appreciate that, Seamus. And I was going to kind of redirect as well. We have to keep this focused on the comments and if the board is going to accept, reject, or modify these comments. So Jessica, why don't you take us one by one?
Okay, so the comments here, I think we have comments by Snell, but then we also have comments by Dr. Arnell, and I think they're really kind of talking about the same thing. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the issue here is that they're feeling that there's duplicate and maybe too much oversight by the treating dentist, if the treating dentist is using a co-op who is also a permit holder.
Is
that accurate? Did I understand that correctly?
So, I really appreciate the comments that you had, Jessica. But the co-op that's a permitted dentist, has always done it this way, and it's not this section wasn't written to put onus on the dentist. It was written because the dental board cannot regulate a non-permitted co-op, and so the only person they can regulate when there's a non-permitted co-op is the dentist. So this 1304 has always been historically from the beginning applied to the dentist that hires a non-permitted co-op. And then it was just recently looped back in with dentists who are permitted. And it's not a question of absolving responsibility. It's that the board needs to be able to regulate anesthesia. They can regulate it through their permitted dentist directly, or they can regulate it through, the dentist that hires the non-permitted co-op indirectly. And the problem is, you know, as the president of the Association for Dentist Anesthesiologists in Arizona, we've shown this to all of all of our members here, and the number of circular problems that this creates is endless, and a lot of confusion, because it's really clear when you say to the permitted dentist, your section is what you're regulated by, you know, your section 1301, 1302, and so on. But then when the section 1304, which was and always has been for non-permitted anesthesia providers, when they started looping, or when at the last minute, when we were looped into it, then it created all of these redundancies. And there is no absolving of responsibility. The permit holder is responsible for what they do. The dentist is responsible for what they do. The QAP.
So Dr. Arnell, I understand where you're coming from. I appreciate the information. I want to redirect this back to the specifics of the language. I'm going to just cut you off. Okay. Jessica, you got your hand up. Go ahead.
So I just want to make sure, because my understanding in part of changing the 1304 permit from a permit to just notifying the board was that we wanted to make sure that dentists who are using a QAP are notifying the board of the QAP that they're using, whether that QAP is another dentist or not. And so I guess my question is, what does the board want? Does the board want this information regardless of whether it's another dentist acting as the QAP or not? Or is it really that as long as if the QAP is a non-licensed dentist, then that's the only time that the board cares to get this information, and otherwise they'll just rely on the licensed dentist operating under their various permits. In other words, if something goes wrong, if a dentist is using another dentist as a QAP and something goes wrong, do you want to essentially say that the QAP dentist is the one who is potentially at fault, or does the board want some sort of apparatus to say that, you know, you guys are both at fault, essentially. Something went wrong and one of you didn't comply with this.
Our language in 1301 already requires that both the permitted dentist and the treating dentist report. It's already there's nothing in 1304 that we aren't already doing in 1301. And then it as you can see, there's this.
But wait a minute. One thing that's not happening in 1301 is a disclosure of the locations where anesthesia is occurring. And that's been, you know, a important point to the board, is knowing what offices are having anesthesia occurring. And that's not addressed in 1301, doctor. So it's not every point is being met. Jessica, I think we need to take it comment by comment. And either accept, reject, or modify them and move on. Because this is otherwise going to be just this circular discussion, and we're going to run out of time tonight. Heath?
Just to help you, Dr. Hero, I think my comment, which is listed first, should probably fall after the board decides on what I think is Dr. Arnell's, Dr. Caputo's comment, because if you go with theirs, mine becomes not a matter. If you don't go with theirs and you keep the language as is, then I feel like mine is pertinent. So just FYI.
I agree with that.
Okay. Dr. Fukami.
So I think this actually ties into my comment that was in the next section. I understand the board's concern that they really want to know where anesthesia is being done. So if that's what it is, if that's the primary reason to have the 1304 notification, then why not build that into the relevant permits for each one? So that means someone who has a 1301 would report to the board to give them a list of the locations that they might be doing anesthesia at. Same with the 1302, same with the 1303. And then on the 1304, simply because they don't have that existing mechanism yet, this notification would serve as that purpose as well. And I think that, if you look at my comments just below the ones that I think you were addressing here, I think that's what I was hoping to incorporate into at least the permitted language, and I can see that that being reproduced in the 1304 as well. I think actually Dr. Caputo already talked about what was in my comment here, which was to make the language stronger that any 1301, 2, or 3 permit holder, when they engage with a QAP, that they have some responsibility within there. I think that that is reflected already in our relevant languages. And if you want each of us as permitted providers to provide that list and that meets what you're looking for with 1304, that just makes sense to me. I think that's a reasonable compromise. Yep.
So if we're going to take this comment by comment, let's start. They're a little bit out of order, but that's fine. Let's start with Dr. Arnell's comment that we should add that is not a dentist licensed in Arizona.
So I already commented on it, but all I'll say is I think Cynthia had a great compromise. We can say 1304 is we can put in that is not a permitted dentist in Arizona, and then take the section in 1304 that requires the list of offices we go to and just put it in 1301, 1302, and so on. And then every permit has all the exact same requirements, and we're not creating all these redundancies of trying to fit all these permits into the 1304 box.
Anthony.
I would disagree a little bit about Cynthia's comment regarding primary intention. I'm not sure that was the board's primary intention for this section, but honestly, I don't think this even has to be in rule. I think when we create the application, any dentist that is applying for a mobile permit should be a trigger that the board then requires a list submission of where they work, and they have to meet that based on their application for that mobile permit. And then I don't even think that that is a big issue there. I think that's the easiest way to address the location issue. What I would say is the larger issue with this approach, and something that Jessica was talking about, and it might have been my misinterpretation, so I'm actually going to defer to her on this, but I'll put the question out there. My understanding is, and Anthony, you mentioned this as well, and I think we see this from a board level, particularly when there are adverse events that occur with patients who have had sedation or anesthesia administered. And that is, who's responsible for the safety and well-being of that patient? I have a particular opinion that we don't operate in silos. So I think to say that the dentist has no responsibility to the health, safety, and well-being of the patient when working with a anesthesia provider, regardless of their background, is any more appropriate than saying that the anesthesia provider has sole responsibility for that patient. So I think the larger issue is, how do we address the responsibility? And maybe that's why Jessica was struggling with the language that I had proposed earlier, is that it maybe in her head she's saying this is addressed in 1304. So honestly, if it's okay with you, I'd like to hear her perspective on this, because I might have been misreading this, but if she feels as though, based on the way I read her comment, that we're addressing that responsibility issue. To me, that's the larger issue here, is responsibility for the safety and well-being of the patient. So I'd like to hear her maybe expound on that a little bit, if you're okay.
Jessica, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'll make a comment, which is why I had my hand raised, and then I'll address Dr. Caputo's question. If we're putting, you can't enforce something on the public, on your licensees, that isn't in rule or statute. And so if you want them to give you this information, it needs to be in your rule somewhere, whether it's here in 1304, whether you address it in each permit specifically, or if you put it on an application for a mobile permit, no matter what, it's going to be in your rules somewhere, because you can't enforce it without it being in your rules somewhere, even if you're just asking for it on an application for a mobile permit. That being said, I think that Dr. Caputo put it probably better than I did, which is, my understanding was that it was twofold for a 1304 permit. The first was to ensure the patient's safety when they're working with a QAP, whether that QAP is another dentist or not. And two, that the board is notified when they're working with a QAP, because otherwise the board has no idea that they are actually employing a QAP and who that is and ensuring that, you know, they meet certain safety requirements. So I think it's twofold. I think it's both the notification to the board that, hey, a QAP's being used and who that QAP is and where they're being used. And I think that it's also ensuring that the dentist who brings on the QAP, even if it's another dentist, still maintains responsibility towards the patient for ensuring that the person they've brought in, even if it's another dentist, has certain things. Those certain things being, you know, the section 1301N and all of that other stuff. I do appreciate, and I think that there is maybe a lack of clarification in that if they are bringing on a QAP and we're referencing 1301N, maybe it needs to be not just 1301N, but something else. Or maybe we don't reference the other permits at all and just identify exactly what it is that they need to ensure that that QAP has, whether it's a PALS or an ACLS or continuing education or whatever it is. I hope I answered Dr. Caputo's question.
Go ahead, Russ.
So the other component of this that I see is the increasing the access to care. You know, that's the reason why we brought in QAPs in the first place, is to be able to have more of our patients in the state of Arizona have access to sedation. And the other component of that is that the dentist working on them, who's not the anesthesia provider, relies heavily on the expertise of those who they bring in. So the onus falls heavier, or should fall heavier, on the anesthesia provider to be ensure the safety. And I see you, you know, shake your head, Dr. Caputo, but if you ask a general dentist what type of medications go in at certain points who don't provide anesthesia, we rely on our providers to be able to provide. Now, the other component of that I also see is that, you know, I agree we have to have a certain level of safety and have the facility set up for that such, but that also should be the QAP's oversight to be able to make sure that they have what they need to provide the service that they need. So that's the thing. If we start decreasing the number of patients that can be seen with anesthesia, the type of dentistry in the state of Arizona goes down, the decreased number of patients that are seen under anesthesia goes down, and these QAPs do a phenomenal job making sure that their safety is being upheld. Additionally, they also have their own boards that if there's an issue, we can, as a dental board, forward that onto their boards to help regulate as well. So that's my
question. I don't want to cut you off, but we just lost our quorum.
Okay.
Jessica, you don't have to answer this now, but we have a board meeting on Friday, and we would have time to add this to an amended agenda to finish this up, barring your availability. And I can call the agenda item whenever you're available. So if you just want to follow up with Ryan after hours and let him know, if you have any availability on Friday, we can add it to our agenda and finish it up then.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to work with Ryan and staff to get that set up. Off the top of your head, do you know if the meeting on Friday would be in the afternoon or in the morning?
It's all day. So okay. That's why. You know, whenever you're available, I can call this agenda item so that we can go through it.
Okay. Yeah, I'll work with Ryan.
If you have an option, afternoon would be better so we can get through our cases in the morning. But at the end of the day, I'm going to defer to whenever you're available.
I will tell you, afternoon is definitely not an option. I am headed out of town on Friday afternoon.
Okay, no problem. And we'll make do whenever you're available. Okay. Seamus?
Doctor, I just want to make sure. So we did lose quorum, right? We do not yes. have. Okay. So I just want to make clear the meeting's over, adjourned. We're done due to the loss of quorum. So, we cannot conduct business or discuss board business anymore.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you everybody. And hopefully we'll be able to, complete this on Friday.